Call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. The hour is 7:30, having arrived. We're very fortunate today to have with us, we've got the Commissioner with us, Commissioner France, and Assistant Commissioner Mossman. We're going to move House File 1231, the Paymar Bill. What I'd like to do first is I'd like to have House Fiscal Staff go through a spreadsheet here, and just so members can kind of go through the whole thing and what we're looking at here. And this is the way we're looking at running it today. As soon as we have a quorum, we'll officially call the meeting. We're getting close. Okay. We've got some minutes here and some different things, but it'd be my intention today to have a quick run through of the numbers. So we have the numbers, and members, Ted, you can take these with you here. And then I'd like to get into public testimony and not a lot of member questioning. That's one of my problems, is I don't like cutting members off at all. But hopefully we can have a lot of the folks that have come in today to give their two-minute testimony. And I'd like to get through as many as we can. If we finish tonight by 11:30 midnight, there's some place wonderful. If not, we are. I don't want to be cutting. We've got our list of testifiers. If we get through them, great. If we don't, we will continue at another meeting. So if we could bring House Fiscal Staff, we do have a quorum. I'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. Representative Carlson moves the minutes of April 13th. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, I will move, or Representative Paymar can move House File 1231. Be recommended to pass. And so we will, first of all, start with the spreadsheets, and I'd like to let the House Fiscal Staff go through it. But first we'll open up for some comments from the author, and then we'll get into testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if these microphones are working, or is it just my hearing?
Testing. It is working? It's on? Okay.
Okay. I can speak loud enough. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to repeat the comments I made at the last hearing. I made some introductory remarks then, so I'll be very brief before we go through the spreadsheet. Again, it's an honor to be presenting Governor Dayton's tax bill to the Tax Committee. Governor Dayton, like all of us, recognizes that we need to make very difficult decisions this year. We can't continue to kick the proverbial can down the street anymore. There's a dead end at the end of that road, and there aren't enough budgetary maneuvers to get us through, regardless of how clever that we think we are. And, Mr. Chair, I think both parties have been guilty of this. We've avoided the inevitable for too long, and we really are at the end of the road. Governor Dayton believes that revenue has to be part of the solution, which is why he has proposed a reasonable and fair bill to resolve our deficit. He has repeatedly said that our income tax system is unfair to the middle class and has rightfully insisted that the majority present a structurally balanced budget so negotiations can begin. We can argue the rest of the session about the tax incidence studies, whether we should factor in federal taxes into the equation, who are the job creators, which investments grow our economy, but I hope at the end of the day we'll make our tax system a little more equitable. I know the minority is opposed to the governor's tax proposal, and not all Democrats support it at this stage. But the governor is not inflexible. He said the other day, if some of the proposed marginal income tax increases are unacceptable to the legislature, he is willing to compromise. The legislature must act responsibly. The citizens of this state cannot continue to pay higher and higher property taxes. We're driving people out of their homes. And shifting state obligations onto counties and cities and cutting or eliminating LGA makes us all poorer as a state. We've heard a lot about living within our means. To the majority, we're in this together. Democrats are as concerned about efficient government as you are. Democrats are as interested in government reform as you are. Democrats are willing to make the hard and painful cuts like you are. We have to. When we were in the majority, we cut the biennial budget $1.2 billion. We made the hard choices, and we will join with you, but not a cuts alone budget. At the beginning of the legislative session, state economist Tom Stinson suggested a balanced approach to the deficit was preferable. House File 1231 is just that. House File 1231 ensures that we invest in our children's future, maintains an infrastructure that we need to grow our economy, and does the least amount of harm given these difficult economic times. Mr. Chair, the Commissioner France and staff from the Dayton administration are here to answer specific questions about his budget and tax changes under the jurisdiction of this committee after you go through the spreadsheet.
Thank you very much.
After we go through the spreadsheet.
Thank you very much, Representative Paymar, for those introductory comments. Let's go to Ms. Templin and Ms. Schill, and then I am very excited about getting into some testimony today where we can have people, whether they like it or have concerns about it, we'll get them some issues out on the table. I certainly do not want to be said at any point that the Tax Committee did not give the governor's proposal consideration. And we are very fortunate today to have, like I said earlier, Commissioner Franz and Assistant Commissioner Mossman with us here. So if we get into some questions for the department, we can certainly do that too. But I really want to focus on the folks that have come here to make their comments to the committee today. Okay, Ms. Templin or Ms. Schill, whoever would like to start. And this is a speed read of the spreadsheet, because I really want to get into testimony from folks that have driven in.
Mr. Chair, Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. I'll be working off this spreadsheet that's entitled House File 1231 at the upper left-hand corner. In addition, I should point out there's also a revenue estimate for House File 1231. The numbers on this spreadsheet and the revenue estimate should match. They do match. The only difference between the two is that the spreadsheet shows the biennial totals. Working off the spreadsheet, on line 8 is for the individual income tax section. There is a provision for a new top income tax bracket at 10.95%, starting at $150,000 for married joint filers. This is effective in tax year 11. It raises $2,042,200,000 in fiscal 12 and 13. In fiscal 14 and 15, this provision is estimated to raise $1.8 billion. This, on line 10, there is a provision to repeal the section 125 health insurance credit. Oh, excuse me, I skipped a line. Line 9, this is the part year residency income tax law modification. This is effective in tax year 11. It raises, estimated to raise $30 million in fiscal 12 and 13, and $30 million in fiscal 14 and 15. Line 10, repeal the Section 125 health insurance credit. This is effective for tax year 12, and this has no impact on the general fund for both biennia. Line 11, the non-resident entertainer tax changes. This has a small revenue, positive revenue impact of $28,000 in fiscal 12 and 13, and $61,000 in fiscal 14 and 15. Line 12, the governor recommends, or excuse me, line 12, this is an increase in the first tier for the R&D tax credit. This is just shows the individual income tax revenue impact for increasing the tax credit from 10% to 15%. And again, this is effective in tax year 11. This there is the cost of $1.3 million in fiscal 12 and 13 and $1.6 million in fiscal 14 and 15. All of the provisions in House File 1231 for related to individual income tax in fiscal 12 and 13 raised $2,070,928,000 in the fiscal 12 and 13 biennium. And in the fiscal 14-15 biennium, the provisions for individual income tax raised $1,897,961,000. Moving on, the corporate franchise tax, lines 21 and 22 show the repeal of the FOC and the foreign royalty subtraction. These provisions are effective in tax year 11, and the combined impact is that these provisions raise $236.9 million in the fiscal 12 and 13 biennium and $207.2 million in the fiscal 14 biennium, 14-15 biennium. Moving on to line 23, the unitary business sales provision. This is effective in tax year 11. It raises $46 million in fiscal 12 and 13 and $40 million in fiscal 14 and 15. Line 24, repeal the exemption for insurance companies. This is effective in tax year 11, and this is estimated to raise $17.4 million in fiscal 12 and 13 and $15.5 million in the 14-15 biennium. Line 25 is the indexing of the corporate tax minimum fees effective in tax year 11. This provision is estimated to raise $14.2 million in fiscal 12 and 13, and again, $14.2 million in the 14-15 biennium. Line 26 of the spreadsheet is the provision for conformity to the foreign partnership income. This is effective in tax year 12 and has an estimated revenue impact of $3 million in fiscal 12 and 13 and $6 million in the tails. Line 27, this is the exclusion of real estate investment trust from the dividend received deduction. This is effective in tax year 12. This has a $1 million impact in fiscal 12 and 13 and $2 million in the tails. Line 28, this is a provision to clarify the research and development credit-based period documentation. This is effective for tax year 11, and this is a cost provision. It has a revenue reduction impact of $400,000 in fiscal 12 and 13, and the same impact in the tails. Line 29, this is the adoption of the economic substance test. This provision is effective in tax year 11 and has a revenue impact, a positive revenue impact of $400,000 in 12 and 13 and $1.7 million in the tails. Line 30, this is, again, this is the provision to increase the first year for the research and development tax credit from 10% to 15%. This line shows the revenue impact for corporations, and this has a cost or a revenue reduction of $12.5 million in fiscal 12 and 13 and $19.1 million in the tails. So to sum up the revenue impact in the corporate tax area in line 32, the provisions in the bill for corporate taxes raised $298 million in fiscal 12 and 13 and $267.1 million in the tails. Line 37 of this spreadsheet shows the cost of the provisions from fiscal 12 to fiscal 15 for federal conformity. I should note that there is also a fiscal 11 cost in the bill, and that is shown. There's more detail shown in pages 5 through 9 of the spreadsheet for the federal conformity provisions in House File 1231. Just to summarize, in fiscal 12 and 13, there is a revenue reduction of $36.2 million in fiscal 12 and 13, and a positive revenue impact of $8 million in the tails for these provisions. And again, if you want to see the details of the conformity provisions in this bill, please see pages 5 through 9 of the spreadsheet. And this detail shows the fiscal 11 revenue impact. Turning the page to page 2, line 42, this is an estate tax provision imposing tax on non-resident decedents with real and tangible personal property in Minnesota. This has a positive revenue impact of $13 million in fiscal 12 and 13 and $16.2 million in fiscal 14 and 15. Moving on to sales tax on line 48, there is a provision, the affiliate nexus and remote sellers. This is effective for fiscal 12, and it has a positive revenue impact of $10.55 million in fiscal 12 and 13, and roughly $13.2 million in the tails. Line 49, this is the exemption for ringtones to maintain compliance with SSUTA, the Streamline Sales Tax Use Agreement. This is a cost. This has a cost, or a revenue reduction of $410,000 in fiscal 12 and 13, and $390,000 in the tails. Moving on to line 50, this is a provision called the Parallel Taxation of Direct Satellite Services. This expands the base and sales tax, and it's estimated to raise $2.3 billion in fiscal 12 and 13. And $2.7 million in fiscal 14 and 15. Moving on to line 51, the online travel lodging reservations provision. This raises $8.550 million in fiscal 12 and 13 and $9 million in the tails. Line 52, there's a provision to, again, expand the sales tax base to include event admissions. This raises $6.9 million in fiscal 12 and 13 and $7.3 million in the tails. There is another provision to expand the base to remote access software. This is estimated to raise $3.4 million in fiscal 12 and 13 and $5.6 million in the tails. Line 54 of the spreadsheet. I should note that we're almost halfway done. So we're almost there. Sourcing rules for florists. This provision is estimated to raise $100,000 in fiscal 12 and 13 and $109,000 in fiscal 14 and 15. Lines 54 and lines 56 have non-general fund impacts, and you can find the revenue impact information on those provisions on line 4 of this, on page 4 of the full spreadsheet. So I am going to jump to line 58. The total sales tax changes with the provisions in House File 1231 have a positive revenue impact of $31.4 million in fiscal 12 and 13 and $38 million in the tails. Okay, moving on to the state property tax. This is a provision to impose the statewide tax on residential property valued over $1 million. Looking at moving right to line 68, this has a positive revenue impact of $62.7 million in fiscal 12 and 13 and $84.7 million in fiscal 14 and 15. Line 72 of the spreadsheet shows provisions related to tax and non-tax initiatives. Line 72 shows the repeal of the tax credit for cigarette and tobacco bad debt. This has a positive revenue impact of $105,000 in fiscal 12 and 13 and $170,000 of positive revenue impact in the tails. Line 73 is a provision to conform to the federal non-admitted insurance. This is on line 73, and it is estimated to raise $1.3 million in fiscal 12 and 13 and $1.8 million in fiscal 14 and 15. Turning the page to page 3, line 76, line 75 shows the total non-tax and other tax initiative revenue impact of $1.4 million in fiscal 12 and 13 and $1.9 million in fiscal 14 and 15. Moving to line 76, this shows the overall total changes recommended in House File 1231 in fiscal 12 and 13. The total revenue change is $2,441,215,000 in the fiscal 12 and 13 biennium. And in the fiscal, in the tails, the revenue The positive revenue impact is $2,314,132,000. Line 77 is just a reference point. The current law general fund tax and non-tax revenue base is estimated to be $32.3 billion in fiscal 12 and 13 and $34.7 million or $8 million in the tails. This is, again, just for line 77 is just a reference. The rest of the spreadsheet, Mr. Chair, again, line 4 just shows the non-general fund impact of the provisions in House File 1231. In lines and in pages 5 through 9 show the detail of the conformity provisions in the bill. And with that, that is a quick summary of the tax revenue changes in House File 1231.
Okay, Ms. Schell.
And Mr. Chair, you have no spreadsheet for any changes for tax aids and credits because there are none. That is the difference between this bill and House File 42 that we have done. So there are no changes to tax aids and credits.
Thank you for your entire presentation, Michelle. Okay. With that, if it's okay with the author, I would really like to get into some testimony of folks that have come in. Okay. The first person to testify will be Aline Mosler. And if I don't do well with your name, please correct me. Well, we're doing well. Oh. Aline Mosler, on deck, Mary Larson, in the hole, Susie Reed. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, and present your testimony.
Thank
you. 2 minutes.
Thank you very much, and my name was pronounced correctly.
Thank you.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Aline Mosler. I'm a member of the League of Women Voters Northfield Cannon Falls and past executive director of the Cannon River Watershed Partnership. In 2008, Minnesota voters supported increasing taxes to protect clean water, land, and legacy. This additional revenue was to supplement, not replace, traditional funding mechanisms. However, in light of current financial realities, careful scrutiny of agency structure and management and changes are necessary. A wholesale reduction of staff and the services they provide would put our natural resources in jeopardy, threatening programs to manage and or protect them for your grandchildren and for mine. Local units of government and citizen groups rely on the expertise, research, and authority of state agencies to develop strategies appropriate to protect their lakes, streams, rivers, and wetlands. For example, the Cannon River Watershed Partnership and the Zumbro River Watershed Partnership rely on the DNR, hydrologists, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency water quality specialists, and Board of Water and Soil Resources programs to develop cost-effective and practical solutions to water quality issues. Keeping soil in the fields benefits water quality and agricultural productivity. And Bowser helps implement programs to make that happen. The commitment of the many volunteer water monitors results in the collection of data that can be interpreted by MPCA scientists and added to that collected by the agency. Good information results in targeted programs. Regulation and enforcement provides the impetus for protecting resources when industries and or communities fail to meet their responsibilities. And also, hydrology is much more complicated than simply knowing that water runs downhill. Understanding water...
Hey, Ms. Mosler, if you wrap it up. And members, I thank you very much, Ms. Mosler, because you've got your testimony. Members have her testimony right here, so thank you.
Okay,
but
I
if
guess
you'd wrap it up, please.
We're urging you to support House File 1231, which asks all Minnesotans to contribute to solving our budget problems. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Mosler. And members, we do have her complete testimony before us. We can take care of that. Okay, next is Mary Larson, and then Susie Reed, and then Rick Cagnes. Mary Larson. If you could state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Sure. Hi, my name is Mary Larson. I'm here actually wearing two hats tonight, so I'm representing myself and my family as taxpayers who would be subject to the higher income bracket, tax bracket, a little nervous. And also I'm a social worker and a member of AFSCME Local 151, and I'm going to talk about how these cuts are affecting us too. So,
2 minutes.
Get started.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm here today to explain why I support House File 1231, Governor Dayton's tax plan. Thanks to my husband's income from his small business, we're privileged to be among those in the proposed fourth tax bracket. And I'm also a social worker for people with serious mental illness. I'm also the granddaughter of a 94-year-old in a Minnesota nursing home, the daughter of a teacher, and a mother who cares about the education of her children. So actually that's many hats here. But starting first with the issue of whether or not it's fair for people of our means to pay some extra taxes on our top dollars, we've discussed this at length around our dinner table. We recognize that we have two nice vehicles, nice place to live, a boat, our kids have 20 grand worth of braces, nice clothes, participate in private sports clubs. We vacationed last year in Australia and the British Virgin Islands. So when we ask ourselves the very moral question of whether we could afford that extra $100 under this tax plan to support Minnesota services, we do, and we gladly will. Last year, every disabled and elderly group home resident in Minnesota lost $20 a month out of their little pocket monies. Elderly disabled people can pay $240 a year to solve the deficit. I think we can pay $100. So that's that hat. Now I'm going to speak as a social worker for Ramsey County Adult Mental Health and an officer of AFSCME Local 151. I've spent a lot of time reviewing this document, which outlines the 109 positions lost in Ramsey County last year and the impact of those lost positions. We've had cuts to everything from corrections to road maintenance to libraries to courts. And I wish I had the time to discuss all of those things because they all make a difference to our quality of life. But I'm only going to be able to touch on 35 positions lost in human services and what that means for our most vulnerable. I think the most common phrase in our budget document is duties reassigned to the caseworker. Workload pressures on our team have become impossible.
Okay, Ms. Larson, if you could wrap it up, please. We're about 30 seconds over.
Well,
if you could provide your testimony to the committee, that'd be great, too.
I will, sure. I guess the main point is that social workers are dealing with very dangerous situations in the community with elderly abuse and neglect, child protection, and psychosis, and practically twitching with anxiety that something bad is going to happen. If we cut more staff, something bad is going to happen.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Susie Reed. And folks, we do not allow signs. We do not allow applause. Okay, Susie Reed and then Rick Cagnes. Okay. Susie.
Hi. Good afternoon. My name is Susie Reed. I support the bill because of the human rights. We doesn't need the rental cuts. I'm concerned for the budget cuts because it affects me greatly. I feel the rental rebate should stay in the budget for many reasons. Each of us who depend on the rebate in some way has already placed the money in use. I have it budgeted for a tooth extraction as soon as I get the refund. It will pay a dental plan to cover costs for next year. You are all aware Social Security does not provide dental coverage. In addition, coverage for medicines prescribed for my disability is included. It would also pay for a portion of my utilities. Unbelievably, it would also enlighten my granddaughter for a couple of days. You can see it is very important for me. I depend on this rebate each year and use every penny to the fullest. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to express my concerns and opinions. It makes me nervous to feel you're going to take it away from us. I just want you to know. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Reed. Okay, we'll now go to Mr. Cagnes, and then after that, I would like to ask the question for folks that are here to testify. We have our list here. Is there anyone that has driven more than 50 miles from more than 50 miles away? Is there anyone that has any? Oh, over. Is it 49 or 51? Oh, time out. Rick, could she? She's got a calculus class. Is that okay?
Oh, sure.
Okay. Yep. You'll be out in 2 minutes.
Well played.
Anybody else with calculus or physics? I hated those two. Oh, man.
What about social studies?
Yeah. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Emma Wright. I am a sophomore at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities and a member of the Minnesota Public Interest Research Group, or MPIRG. MPIRG is a student-directed nonprofit organization with 8 chapters across the state. Today I'm here, skipping class, because I feel that it's important that you understand how far-reaching and devastating the proposed cuts to higher education and transportation will be on students in Minnesota. I'm here because this committee has the opportunity to raise revenues and create a more balanced budget. I grew up in Apple Valley, Minnesota, and now live in Minneapolis, and similar to many graduate and undergraduate students attending school in the Twin Cities, I live off campus. And this semester, I have class on East Bank, West Bank, and St. Paul campuses, but I don't have a car. What I do have is a job, 19 credits at the U, volunteering, and when I like to think I do have a social life when I do have a little bit of time for that, but this means I operate on a tight schedule, and the only way I'm able to get around is on time is the transit system. It is a vital part of my life, the lives of my roommates, my friends, and many other students at the university and in the Twin Cities. By making these cuts, you are preventing access to groceries. You are preventing a way to get to school. You are preventing a way to get to work. You are preventing a way to feel comfortable traveling alone at night and to access the businesses trying to survive in this economic recession. But that is only a portion of the consequences. As I mentioned before, I am more than a transit rider. I'm a student. And as a student of a public university with 2 years left to go, the proposed cuts will directly affect my education and future. I have 2 hardworking parents with small businesses, and I have 2 siblings, but between my brother and I in school, we are already generating about $40,000 in tuition money a year. At the university, I witnessed firsthand the innovation, the leadership, the community, the groundbreaking research and education that is fostered and developed in students who are preparing for the workforce. We are the future of Minnesota. The 13% cuts proposed for higher education.
Hey, Ms. Wright, if you could wrap it up, please.
I'm almost done. Yep. Would put funding at a level similar to a decade ago. It is hard for me to reconcile how the university could possibly operate and foster this the same growth at that level. The idea of taking that away is very disheartening, and I am witnessing a disinvestment in my education when there is an alternative plan possible. Whether it is cuts to transit or to higher education, you can see that it will cause significant problems for many. On behalf of myself, countless other riders, citizens, and students who would be impacted by these cuts, I urge you to raise revenues and take a balanced approach to Minnesota's state budget problem.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wright. Good luck in class.
Thank you.
Please. Folks, let's hear what folks have to say. We don't need to clap our hands. Okay, next, Rick Cagnus. Then we've got, is there anyone here that has any health issues or anything where you need to kind of give your testimony and take off? Are you going to stay here? Okay, we'll go with Mr. Cagnus, and then we'll go to you, ma'am, and then we'll keep going here.
It's okay. Cardenas.
So that's me, Rick Cardenas. Rick Cardenas.
Cardenas, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Yeah, I'm Rick Cardenas, and I work for Advocating Change Together in St. Paul.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thanks for allowing me to speak. I would like to address how I see the role of this committee. I see it reflected in of course, the revenue, but also that revenue reflects the values that the rest of the committees present. Right now, many of those committees, because of the budgets, are doing major cuts mean, over $300 million to programs for wayward services. Many cuts proposed to physical therapy, occupational therapy, adaptive equipment, which I need a lot, a wheelchair, things to write and things to adaptive equipment to use computers. We don't know what the numbers will precisely be, but we know that this is the trickle-down theory in actual practice. The cuts here are going to trickle down to the rest of the committees. Around the Capitol, which I am probably around too much this year, people are saying that charities and churches and religious groups should take this. But that reminds me of 500 years ago, in 1601, the Elizabethan poor laws were directed because the churches and the religious groups could not do the services that the state could do. The state took over that role, and the king in England decided that each parish and all of those earls and lords and guys with money had to assign a tax collector. And that's what you are right now, are the ones who are signing those taxes. And it reflects the values that we'll have down the line in all of those other committees, the transportation committee, the deed committee, the health and human services for sure. And those Elizabethan poor laws said we should visit the sick, visit the prisoner, welcome the stranger, feed the hungry, and clothe the poor. Actually clothe the naked, but I don't want to get dirty here. So
if you could wrap up, please, we're a little bit over.
So over 500 years ago is when that became a part of our value structure. We seem to be shifting to 500 years ago. Around the Capitol, I'm hearing that this is a mean and cruel budget, but I try to tell the people that say that these are just different values, and we have to see that our values are presented more clearly. I mean, however, these cuts are so bad, I don't even think we're going to have summer this year. So I think we've got to work on those values and increase taxes to reflect Minnesota and the rest of the country. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cargness. We will now go to the lady that had raised her hand over here. If you could come on down. That's fine. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
I'm Nancy Marie Lund.
Welcome.
I didn't hear your...
And who you represent, please.
I'm representing myself.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Lund.
And others like myself. My health issues are the most important thing to see if we get coverage. I have mental illness. I'm bipolar with depression and with psychotic features. And I haven't been able to work basically for 8 years because my mental illness has been so bad. And it's not that I don't want to work, it's that I can't work because I'm not stable enough. But luckily, I found a medication that works, and it's so hard to get a medication to work. They're now stating that we can just go on any medication that should take care of it, and it's not that way at all. It takes, like, some people three times at least to go on just depression medication. For myself, my mental illness is very difficult, and my medication costs a lot, and I know I'm aware of it, and I ask that you do not cut medical assistance, because without it I will not be able to survive, and I cannot go on any other medication. I'm starting to feel good where I think I'm able to work at least part time. and I'm not able to work full-time just because I never know when it's going to act up, because as I get older and older, my mental illness gets worse, and I also have a head injury, TBI, brain damage done, that also hinders me what type of job I can get, and one overlaps the other. So I don't know if you understand that, but I can write up something to briefly give you my circumstances and other people's circumstances as well.
That'd be wonderful, Ms. Lund. Thank you very much for your testimony.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, we'll now go to Jamie Platt. If Jamie could join us.
Hey.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
I am Jamie Platt, and I represent myself, GA.
Welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you. My name is Jamie Platt. I'm here to support revenue for a number of reasons. I am a single mother with an associate's degree in business management, and I'm also a survivor of domestic violence. We were evicted after the father of my kids assaulted me, and as a result, the landlord chose not to renew our lease. We became homeless. We stayed with friends for a while, then at a shelter, but ultimately ended living in my car. Then one day we woke up, and there was about 4 inches of snow on the ground, and that's when my getting on my feet wasn't as easy as I hoped and required some real effort. I was homeless, unemployed, had a 1- and a 2-year-old, my bipolar disorder and PTSD from the traumatic assault where I was duct taped and strangled had gone untreated, and I made a very tough decision. Someone else needed to care for my daughters and give them the stability that I could not. I acquired funding through Ramsey County Victim Witness Advocates, and they helped me to relocate my children to Arizona so my mom could provide a temporary guardianship while I finished testifying at the trial of my ex. General assistance supplements my income by making it possible to pay rent at Mary Hall, by affording my 9 medical co-pays to treat my depression and bipolar, and it provides public transportation getting me to and from these appointments. But most of all, it makes the distance of 1,700 miles not so far away when I can hear my children's voices over the phone when I tuck them in at night. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll now go to Sue Watlaw Phillips, and then Nell Hurley, then we'll go to Ben Kiriagis. So, Sue Watlaw Phillips.
Good evening, Mr. Chair. I'm Sue Watlaw Phillips. I'm Executive Director of Elam Transitional Housing, Treasurer of MICA and the National Coalition for the Homeless, a member of the National Republican Congressional Committee. I own 2 for-profit businesses in Minneapolis area and northern Minnesota. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 1231. We support many of the provisions in this bill that the governor is bringing forward. At the same time, we do not believe it goes far enough. Elam started as a church-based shelter in the winter of 82-83. We serve over 6,000 people at risk or experiencing homelessness, helping people get back into housing, get jobs, and move on with their lives. So I'd like to just illustrate why it doesn't go far enough, and if you'll just pardon my illustrations, I do not want to make fun by any means of what we're doing here tonight, but I think it'll help people understand a little bit better what we're talking about. On the appropriation side, we do a very, very good job of talking about how we spend money. This year, in this next biennium, as well as this biennium, we'll spend a little bit less than, what each penny represents $1 million, a little bit less than $1 million on shelter and on homeless youth programs. And then about a little less than $6 million in the biennium on transitional housing. Now, for our prevention program, we're going to spend about 15
$1.5 million over the biennium. Same as what we did last 2 years, which we greatly appreciate. In the housing area, we have about this much, which is a little bit less than last time. And in the long-term homeless program, we have $10 million, which is about $3 million less. So one of the things that we've had as an issue for a while is that we keep kind of jumping around. And I'm just going to bring out a couple of
Ms. Phillips, if you could wrap it up. You're over 2 minutes, please.
Okay. Quick friend. This is our bunny from this weekend and a couple glasses. I'm just going to very quickly just show you what we do on the mortgage interest deduction, which I have copies
okay,
here.
Okay, ma'am, we're way over. If we could go to the next testifier, please.
Okay, I
set them right up.
Nell Hurley.
So this is what we're going to do in the biennium.
Thank you, Ms. Phillips. Is Ms. Hurley here?
Thank you.
Chair, you should be nicer to the Easter bunny, you know that.
Tastes like chicken. Ms. Hurley, if you could join us here, please.
Sir.
Yeah, I wanted to see what the bunny was going to...
Oh, the bunny was just talking about all the money that we're not using.
That's why I don't allow props.
Should I go ahead?
Yeah, if you could state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Nell Hurley. I am the executive director of a nonprofit organization in St. Paul called Minnesota Recovery Connection. My testimony is timed out at 2.5 minutes, so bear with me. Minnesota Recovery Connection works to connect individuals and families to the resources they need in order to enter and sustain long-term recovery from addiction to alcohol and other drugs. So I'm here as a representative of the recovery community and Minnesota Recovery Connection, but I'm also here today as a woman in long-term recovery, and what that means for me is that I have not taken a drink or a drug in over 13 years. As a person in recovery who has received recovery support, I went through treatment twice before finally sobering up. I urge you to support a balanced approach rather than an all-cuts approach to the budget. We must ensure that individuals and families and people who need it the most have access to life-changing recovery resources in the same way that I did 13 years ago. I'm here before you today to help put a face on recovery and to show you just what access to recovery can mean for individuals, families, and whole communities. While I used to be someone who contributed to the cost of addiction on society, I'm now able to contribute to society because of my recovery and the recovery support I've received. So let me tell you what I mean. Today, I am employed. I pay state and federal income taxes and contribute to Social Security. I'm college educated. I quit smoking and became a 5-time marathon finisher. And I'm a certified yoga instructor, and I provide a free weekly yoga class to other men and women in recovery from addiction. In my recovery, I have not once visited a hospital emergency room. I have not compromised the safety of myself or others by driving drunk. I've not provided drugs to others or alcohol to minors. I've not been arrested. I've not been incarcerated. I've not lost my faculties or my rights. I am a voter, and except for a few parking tickets, I obey the law. Also, very importantly, I'm an engaged, attentive, and loving mother to my child. This is my son. His name is Jasper. He's 6 years old. He has not ever once seen me drunk or high or hungover. I've achieved this because I was afforded the support I needed in order to recover from my disease. So just as you do, I now, too, help make Minnesota stronger. When we promote the solution to addiction and make sure recovery
Hurley,
resources
up, please,
are accessible to everyone who needs it, we not only help addicts and alcoholics, people like me, but we strengthen the recovery community itself and we enrich Minnesota as a whole. Because just as addiction affects all of us, recovery benefits everyone, all of society. So I urge you to support a balanced approach to the budget. I urge you to consider the consequences of deeper cuts, which ultimately cost our state much, much, much more. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hurley. Representative Paymar, do we need to get somebody to, I don't want people walking on glass there.
Well, if they're not there, but Mr. Chair, they're okay with that.
Okay, well, we'll just take a second and get that cleaned up a little bit here. Thank you. Mr.
Ben
Kyriadis, please present your testimony.
Yes. My name is Ben Kyriadis. I'm here to speak for myself. I'm a resident of Plymouth for 24 years. I have a degree in business and also an MBA. I'm a small business owner. My family taxable income last year was well over $150,000, and I fully understand that if the governor's tax bill passes, I will be paying more taxes. I'm here to support the governor's tax plan. The way I see it, it's a matter of price versus value. In my 33 years of business experience, I learned that companies that focus on value are usually more successful over the companies that focus on low prices. And I think this applies to states also. If we compete on the basis of low taxes, there will always be someone like South Dakota or Texas or Florida that will have even lower taxes. How do you compete with a state that has zero tax for income? We must compete on the basis of our strength, and the biggest strength of our state is the people of Minnesota and our quality of life. I recently checked the unemployment rates of those seven states that have zero income tax. And I was surprised to find that five out of those seven taxes with zero income tax actually have higher unemployment rate than the state of Minnesota. And state of Minnesota has income tax rate from 535 to 785. So I think the question should be, what do we need to pay to ensure the quality of life here in Minnesota and the quality of life for our children and to continue to compete on that basis? It has been said that a cynic is someone that knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. As a small business owner,
sir, if you could wrap it up, please. And okay. Members, we do have his entire testimony before us.
Yes.
Here, so I thank
I will close by saying that Minnesota needs to invest in people because that's the only sustainable competitive advantage that we have. And if we invest in people, people like me who can afford to pay more will not mind paying more because when Minnesota does better, we will do even better. And I will close with a quote from Oliver Wendell Holmes, a Supreme Court justice of last century, who said, "I like paying taxes. With them, I buy civilization." Civilization is another word for quality of life.
Thank you very
much for your support.
Sir. Thank you. Robert Fisher, Michael Beckman. Robert Fisher, Mikhail Beckman. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Good evening. My name is Robert Fisher. I represent myself as well as St. Stephen's Human Services. Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Robert Fisher. I've been a successful business owner and a past recipient of state programs, critical to my recovery from catastrophic events that destroyed my world. I'm here to support the governor's proposal. This is not a problem just about the wealthiest Minnesotans or the poorest. It's a problem for every Minnesotan. Every legislative decision has a ripple effect, affecting the lives of real people in our state. What do we collectively want to say? I know what I want to say, and that's that I love the state of Minnesota. It's been a part of my successes, and it was there when I had all but given up on myself. That's the Minnesota that I love. Under current proposals, it appears to me that we are saying to Minnesotans, we don't feel investing in you is fiscally prudent. Therefore, fend for yourselves. This is not the Minnesota culture I grew up with. That culture set us apart as a leader in many areas. What happened to our compassion? What happened to our sense of community? I implore you to consider the revenue side of the equation. I'm willing to pay $100, which is what I understand is the amount the average household with an AGI of over $150,000 would pay in additional income taxes if the governor's proposal it goes into effect. My AGI is 20% of that, and yet I'm willing to do that, and I challenge others with more than I have to do the very same thing. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Mr. Beckman. Thank you, Mr. Fisher. If you could please state your name and who represents.
Hi, folks. My name is Mikkel Beckman, and I'm here basically to represent myself. I'm the CEO of a nonprofit company in Minneapolis. I'm a little flummoxed. I worked all day and ran home because my wife was at PTA and had to feed the kids and get the homework train on the track. But I really wanted to say, in my line of work, I think the greatest sin of any nonprofit is to be deaf to people, and I think that applies to politicians too, so I really thank you for your attention and for listening. I know you've got a hard task ahead of you this session, and I wouldn't want to be in your shoes this session necessarily. I am here to speak in favor of a mix of cuts and revenue, and I think that's, you know, the leadership that we're looking to in this body. I don't come here ever, and so it's the first time I've ever testified, but you guys need to come together and show some real leadership for us. I think, you know, people have spoken about quality, and I was going to speak to the same thing and just to bullet points a few things. You know, corporate recruiters will tell you this is the hardest state to recruit people into, but it's the hardest state to recruit people out of once they've come here. People come here and they fall in love with this place. I've created 75 jobs in the last 4 years, so I guess I'm a job creator of some sort, going from 30 staff to 105. And I have to tell you that you know, I grew up here. My family came here from Stanley, North Dakota when I was little, looking for opportunity. We found it here. You know, we live better than 99% of the people on the face of the earth. We live better than most other Americans. We're healthier, apparently, and smarter by all the surveys. Our water's the cleanest. Our air's the cleanest. You know, we produce wonderful children who go off. And, you know, if you go out east, they call us the brains of the United States. Most of the people running the show out east are Midwesterners and a lot of Minnesotans. And our parents and grandparents have built up a place that most people don't even get to dream about. And that has been through, yes, taxes. And not only that, but, you know, we hear that we're a high-tax state a lot, but we're also a high-income state. You know, we have higher incomes than most people.
Mr. Beckman, if you could please wrap it up.
And so I would just really encourage you to look at increased revenue as part of this mix to preserve the quality of life that we have here, that we all love. And I know times are hard, but I do feel like that's got to be part of the equation. You guys should come together somewhere in the middle. You may not like as much of the revenue as the governor's proposing, but, you know, you got to move a little bit in there, I think. So thank you for your time.
Mr. Beckman, have you ever been to Tagus, North Dakota?
Tagus? No.
Not too far from Stanley.
Stanley. Montreal County?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
A lot of oil out there.
Okay. Elaine Wynn. Elaine Wynn, if you could please join us. Elaine. And then next will be Jamie Delton, then Mr. Dane Smith, who can talk all about loopholes for his 2 minutes if he'd like. Ms. Wynn? Okay. Let's go to Jamie Delton, then my good friend Dane Smith, and then Donna Quinn. Jamie Delton. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jamie Delton. I'm with Minnesota Internet Tax Freedom Group, purpose of which is to pass the Minnesota Internet Tax Freedom Act. I have three items that I would like to have removed from Article 4, and I think it would actually increase the revenue that that these items are expecting. The first two are the nexus items, and the last item is the nine new taxes that are in Article 4. First two are the solicitor and affiliated groups references. Governor Dayton, the legislature, and Minnesota should oppose any agenda to curtail or end internet tax freedom or to establish any national sales tax, VAT, or business-to-business tax. Removing the two items from the governor's bill is a critical first step to demonstrate sincerity in bringing Minnesota back from last place in a recent Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council study, which rated each state's business environment. We should preserve the Quill Doctrine and provide for our children the same internet opportunities we enjoy. And the nine new taxes are the network access, amusement events, exhibition events, trade shows, boat shows, garden shows, hotel provider services, hotel intermediary services, and internet floral sales. Texas and Illinois did the same thing, and the business fled from there. And Hawaii's governor rejected similar legislation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, sir. Next, we are fortunate to have with us Dane Smith, and then Donna Quinn and John Thorson. Mr. Smith, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Chairman Davids, committee members, I'm Dane Smith, President of Growth and Justice. We're a research organization focused on economics and tax and budget issues. We favor this legislation. We're pro-business and pro-government, and we think that profits and taxes in the right balance are good for Minnesota. Quick sets of facts. Context is crucial. One, relative to previous years when the bottomest of the bottom lines, our price of government is down and headed for an all-time lowest level in 25 years. Two, the historically large state income tax cuts a decade ago were followed by an actual decline in Minnesota's economic performance relative to previous decades, relative to other states, and in the condition of middle-income and lower-income families. The claim that tax cuts and low taxes are all that we would need and that this would deliver an economic bonanza simply has not been borne out by the facts. Three, relative to other states, we have declined sharply in the tax and budget rankings. We now typically rank around 20th in taxes as a percent of income, and about 30th in expenditures as a percent of income. Last fall, we calculated that an all-cuts budget would sink us to 40s, into the 40s on those rankings, down with Deep South states in the vicinity of Oklahoma. Governor Pawlenty, years ago when we began this experiment, said that he wanted us out of the top 10, but that he did not want Minnesota to be a Deep South state in the quality of its public sector. Four, taxing top incomes makes sense in the context of both widening inequality in income and wealth and widening regressivity of our tax incidence. Top incomes now have tripled their share of income in the last 30 years. Tax incidence study shows that top incomes pay a smaller share and that the chronic state local regressivity is not getting better. And five, and this is most important, the evidence is clear that sound public investments in human capital and physical infrastructure builds a foundation for a broader and lasting prosperity. The evidence shows that public education pays off from early childhood all the way to technology research, production of more PhDs, first-rate public transportation, water and sewer pays off, and broader health and economic security pays off because everybody then has enough to buy the things that our businesses are selling. Made it in 2 minutes. Thank you very much, Chairman Davis.
That was awesome, Mr. Smith. Thank you very much. Donna Quinn, John Thorson, and then Jennifer Schaubach. Ms. Quinn, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Donna Quinn, and a member of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. I am a licensed practical nurse at Serenity Care Center in Bethesda, South St. Paul. I am here to support House File 1231. Representative Paymar's bill will keep the promise Governor Dayton has made to us. it will ask the richest 6% to pay their fair share of taxes. For the last 8 years, they are the one group that has sacrificed the least to balance our budgets. Can anyone remember a time when the richest had so much more than the rest of us? I work in a nursing home caring for seniors. There is something wrong when someone like me pays more of my income in taxes than a bank CEO. That is why 94% of the Minnesota families, including my family, will see no income tax increase with this plan. We are told that the top 6% cannot pay more in taxes because they are job creators. Well, members of the committee, I am a job creator too. I pay a lot of bills. Those bills create jobs. There is no one in this world that can create a job without a consumer like me to pay those bills. In fact, I am a lot better at creating jobs than most of our best paid CEOs. Pretty much every cent I earn gets paid out and creates jobs. In contrast, the well-paid CEOs of United Healthcare Group are biggest HMOs and the big banks are all sitting on a record levels of cash. That cash should be creating jobs instead of sitting in a bank. For the last 8 years, Minnesota has balanced its budget on the backs of healthcare workers and middle-class families. Healthcare workers have had rates cuts, funding cuts, delays of rebalancing, and the unallotment of GAMC. Minnesota nursing homes and hospitals have been shedding jobs and cutting hours. Those of us left are stretched to the max and have unsafe patient and resident care loads. You have a choice. You can be on the side of the 6% who in living memory have never had it better. Or you can be on the other side of the rest of us. You could be on the side of the people who every year get left further behind. Let's make this the year we start going forward together.
Thank you very much.
I did it.
Thank you very much, Ms. Quinn. Mr. John Thorson, AFSCME. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Thorson with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Council 5. We represent 42,000 women and men who provide public services in the state of Minnesota and work hard every day. On behalf of our members, I'm pleased to support House File 1231, the governor's tax bill, in part because it is a balanced approach to our state's $5 billion deficit solution. And unlike the bills that have been passed through this committee in the Senate, an all-cuts approach, quite frankly, costs too much for the state of Minnesota. Costs too much in terms of jobs, costs too much in terms of the services that Minnesotans need, and it costs too much in terms of moving our economy forward. Since 2002, there are, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 7,793 fewer employees of local government in the state of Minnesota. These are folks, that's fewer cops, this is not education, so cops, child protection workers, social workers, librarians, and these are the folks that make Minnesota work. The cuts involved in the bills that have been passed by both the House and the Senate, because of there not being revenue, the LGA cuts to the cities of the first class exacerbate these job cuts at a time, quite frankly, when there's 200,000 Minnesotans right now unemployed, competing for 30,000 jobs. And the further cuts to employment are a detriment to our state moving forward. Minnesotans need these services. They're paying more for them because of the property tax increases that are inherent in a bill that doesn't have revenue. And again, a balanced approach has been put forward by the governor is one that is wholeheartedly supported by the members of AFSCME.
Thank you very much, Mr. Thorson. Jennifer Schaubach, Joe Matthews, Keith Carlson. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Schaubach. I am the legislative director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO,
which is a committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are a labor federation made up of more than 1,000 affiliated unions representing more than 300,000 working men and women throughout the state. While we acknowledge Governor Dayton's budget makes very difficult cuts, he does finally make long overdue investments in students and communities while asking everyone to do their part in building a better future for Minnesota. The governor has presented a balanced path forward to save and create jobs. We continue to hear a lot about business, but very little about the hardworking Minnesotans that make those businesses successful. They have paid for the tax breaks for high-income earners and businesses with their jobs, their homes, and their lives. Too many Minnesotans are still unemployed or underemployed and struggling to put food on their table and keep their homes. Many families who suffered a job loss during the recession find themselves in a more dire situation today than they were a year or two ago. Although the job market has seen little improvement since the recession ended, workers who cannot find jobs are now seeing their public services being sacrificed for more breaks to the wealthy and businesses. Government spends an enormous amount of money each year on corporate income tax credits, property tax abatements, direct cash grants, et cetera, to lure large companies or to retain those already here. Many businesses regularly uproot to follow economic opportunity. However, quality of life is an equally important factor in their decision to stay or go, as well as good schools, clean air and water, and low crime. All of these public services and all of these have been neglected over the last 8 years. On what basis can subsidy agreements be considered sacred while public sector collective bargaining agreements and pension obligations are torn to shreds? It is time to stop the war on the middle class. It's time to stop the attacks on our nurses, firefighters, and teachers who provide priceless public services to our state. Putting Minnesotans back to work and rebuilding our communities should be our number one priority.
Ms. Schaubach, if you step it up, please.
Minnesota's economic future depends on laying the foundation for long-term economic growth by making sound investments in our schools, our infrastructure, and our workers. We need these investments for our economy to grow, and we need our highly skilled, highly educated workforce to put these policies into effect. The Minnesota AFL-CIO stands with Governor Dayton in his bold initiative to finally address our state's revenue crisis fairly, and we hope you will as well and vote yes on House File 1231.
Thank you very much, Ms. Schaubach. Mr. Matthews, Keith Carlson, Patricia Nauman. Mr. Matthews. Okay, representing AMC, if you could please state your name and who you represent, please, for the record, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am not Joe Matthews. I am Jim McDonough, Ramsey County Commissioner, past president of the Association of Minnesota Counties and representing the Association of Minnesota Counties. 87 counties, 434 county commissioners, all elected by the same citizens that elect each and every one of you, representing the same citizens that you represent. The Association of Minnesota Counties supports a structurally balanced budget. We support a revenue increase, we support redesign and restructuring, and we support cuts. We do not believe that it should be any harder or any easier to increase revenues than it is to impose cuts or to do redesign or restructuring. I've heard many members say this is not the time to increase revenue. I would say, and I have to do this every year in our budget in Ramsey County, there is never a good time to increase revenue. When we increase revenue, it should be deliberate. We should understand the consequences, and we should be accountable for it. Exactly the same approach we should take when we're imposing cuts on people. We should be accountable. We should take the consequences for that. We should know what the impacts are. No one tool should be easier to use than any other tool we have. These are the three tools we all have to use to provide a structurally balanced budget. We believe that since that fateful day in Jesse Ventura's administration when Pam Wheelock said we have boatloads of money and the solution was one-third back to the taxpayers, one-third cuts, and one-third spending increases, we have been in a structurally unsound budget since then. And we continue to deal with a deficit year after year after year after year. And until we use all the tools to solve this budget and put it in a position that we can move forward as a state with a structurally sound budget, and when we say all the tools, that means an increase in revenue, this state will continue to have a problem with this budget. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I certainly could stand for any questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. McDonough. We'll now go to Mr. Carlson, Patricia Nauman, and then Gary Carlson. Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Keith Carlson. Okay, we'll go to Patricia Nauman, then Gary Carlson, and then Steve Peterson. Welcome to the committee. Thank you. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. I'll be very brief this evening. I want to speak, first of all, to our appreciation in the governor's, in House File 1231, the governor's budget, for the absence of any reductions to local government aid, market value homestead credit, and the property tax refund programs. This is a statement of and reflects that LGA is a priority in this budget, and that is very consistent with our policies of opposing further reductions to those programs. I do want to also voice support for the online travel sales tax clarification for the intermediary on the accommodations that allows for the remission of taxes to the state for state and local governments. We do appreciate that clarification and change. And I do want to express concern with one provision in the bill, that is the statewide property tax on high-valued homes. Our policies do oppose extension of this tax on other classes of property because of the fact that the property tax is the primary source of revenue for cities. So we do want to express some concern about that piece. Our policies do not speak specifically to any two specific revenues or reductions other than that we oppose LGA reductions, of course, but we do support changes that we think this bill does reflect that improve stability and adequacy in our state's revenue and budget system. So I do want to voice appreciation for that, and I will stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. We will now go to Gary Carlson, Steve Peterson, Kate Johansson. Mr. Carlson, please state your name and who represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. Let me start by saying that cities across the state certainly understand the challenges you face in trying to balance your budget. This is an immense challenge, and our cities face it with you each year through every one of these recent budget crises. Solving deficits during these challenging times are a task that needs to be handled very carefully. Raising taxes has consequences, and making budget cuts has consequences. And I think the challenge before you is to find the best way to maximize the cost-benefit ratio to citizens in Minnesota between raising taxes and cutting services. League's policies do not support specific tax increases, but our cities have, in their infinite wisdom, adopted a policy that strongly urges you to find a more stable overall state budget. We've been through budget crises since the early 2000s, and those fluctuations have trickled down to the local level, and we've had to deal with the repercussions of those cuts. We really think the state ought to spend a lot of time finding a way to stabilize its revenue stream. If you look back just a few years ago, I think state revenues were projected to be well in excess of $37 billion for this current FY 10-11 biennium. Those revenues came in well under that, about $4.5 to $5 billion under that. Just due to the circumstances surrounding the economic downturn. We urge you to consider all sources of revenue. We urge you to consider all portions of your state budget in solving your budget crisis. Finally, the League's policies do speak specifically to three specific items in the governor's bill. Number one, federal conformity, especially as it relates to the extension of health care benefits to children under age 27. That's become an administrative headache for our cities. We'd like to make that a permanent fix in the federal conformity laws as the governor has proposed in his bill. We do support the affiliate nexus provisions, as I've testified before. We think Main Street businesses need to have a level playing field with the online retailers, and we would support the provisions under affiliate nexus. And then finally, the online lodging sales tax provisions, we also support those. Those do have an implication for local lodging tax revenues as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carlson, Mr. Peterson, and then a representative of the Minnesota Realtors.
Mr. Chair, I have a handout of bets. Okay.
Yes. Yeah, we'll get these passed out. Welcome, okay. Committee. Sir, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Steve Peterson. I'm here on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. We are here because we do support the governor's article on aids and credits, which, of course, is non-existent from this bill, in that there is no article on aids and credits or cuts in this bill. In 2010, the paid LGA was 25% less than what was paid out in 2002 without adjusting for population or inflation. and total aids and credits to cities on a per capita basis are down 63% from their high in 1990 when adjusted for inflation. Rather than causing the deficit, property tax aids and credits have repeatedly been part of the solution, forcing local governments to make decisions on spending cuts and property tax increases. These cuts, of course, have not come quite as equally as everyone would like. On the chart that has been handed out to you, you can see that cities that were certified to receive LGA in 2010 have seen a 26% increase in property taxes per person adjusted for inflation, while their revenue base is down 13%, while cities that did not receive LGA have a property tax increase of 9%, while their revenue base is down just 1%. The coalition supports a balanced budget approach to solve the state budget. That does mean the use of statewide revenue increases. The coalition believes it is better to raise statewide taxes than further reductions in local government aids and credits, unequal property tax increases and service cuts across this, at the local level. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Peterson. We'll now go to a representative from the Realtors, and then we'll go to Andy Welch and Matt Toberin, I believe. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Kate Johansson, and I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Association of Realtors, which represents nearly 20,000 real estate professionals throughout the state. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this evening. I'm here to express the Minnesota Association of Realtors' opposition to one provision in the governor's budget, and that provision is the imposition of a new state residential property tax. The Realtors oppose this provision for four reasons in particular. The first is that the Realtors feel that the state is not the appropriate entity to impose a residential property tax, but rather that property taxes are better administered on a local level. Second, our organization has traditionally opposed policies that single out one group to solve statewide problems, and we feel that this provision violates that policy. Third, we're concerned that this property tax would negatively impact an already ailing housing market. And fourth, Minar is concerned that if imposed, this tax would ultimately be expanded to other properties in the future. Despite our opposition to this one particular provision, I'd also like to express our association's appreciation to the governor for explicitly retaining the property tax refund program, and we'd also like to express our appreciation that he did not include modifications to the mortgage interest deduction or a proposed real estate tax on sales tax on real estate services. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much, Ms. Johansson. We'll now go to Andy Welch and Matt Toberin. I hope that's right. I guess we'll find out.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Matt Toberin, representing SEIU Local 284, the Union of Public School Sports Staff. Unfortunately, Andy Welch, who's a custodian in West Tonka School District, is ill today and wasn't able to attend, but we're fortunate to have Valerie Ralstead to share her experiences with you today.
Okay. Ms. Ralstead. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, and if we could get a spelling of your last name, please.
I appreciate, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name's Valerie Ralstead, R-O-L-S-T-A-D.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. And I'm a special ed paraprofessional in a Level 3 EBD program in Columbia Heights School District, and I live in Fridley with my husband and three children, and I'm also a proud member of SEIU Local 284. As legislators, you have a clear choice in front of you. On one hand, you can continue to slash the funding for schools, roads, and jobs, and balance the state budget on the backs of working families. Or you could support a reasonable solution that recognizes that we have cut most of the fat out of our budget, and it's time for all Minnesotans to pay their fair share of taxes to restore our state. This bill is that solution. It merely asks the wealthiest Minnesotans, those that have benefited from our great state, to reinvest in our state. Right now, the richest 5% of Minnesotans are paying a lower effective tax rate than Minnesota's working families. That's wrong, and this bill corrects it. I also want to point out that this bill will not raise the taxes of 95% of Minnesotans, not by a penny. This bill ensures that by asking the wealthiest among us to pay their fair share, we can avoid drastic cuts to the children I see every day and in the community that we live in. On behalf of Minnesotans, working families, I urge you to support this bill and help rebuild the middle class and not to cut our legs out from under us anymore. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Rolstead. We'll now go to Nan Madden, Monica Nelson, Brian Roosh, and Jen Oscarson. Nan Madden, if you could please join us. Welcome to the Tax Committee. If you please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. And I'd like to start by thanking you, Mr. Chair, for holding this hearing. This is not the kind of discussion we normally have in Tax Committee. I'm a big a tax geek as anyone, and I love to have those discussions, but this hearing today really reminds us what taxes are for and why we have that discussion here. We see the public sector as a partner with Minnesota residents, the nonprofit sector, and the business community, working together to build a state with a high quality of life and in which all people have the opportunity to succeed. Our state and our economy benefit from public investments, including infrastructure, the human capital of our residents, and the way we care for each other and ensure that all people can live in dignity. The national economic recession hit our state hard, and like most other states, we face a challenge of how we meet our needs and invest in the future. We are pleased that the governor has taken a balanced approach that uses both revenue increases and spending cuts to balance the budget. We are even more convinced that a balanced approach is a better solution for the state, as we've had a chance to see what the alternative is. And you've heard today from the previous testifiers from their own experience about what it means and the damage that will happen if we follow a cuts-only approach. The legislature's budget balancing plan asks low-income people, persons with disabilities, the elderly, job seekers, and other vulnerable populations to play a disproportionate role in helping solve the budget deficit. Over time, we've shifted more responsibility for funding state and local services onto low and moderate income Minnesotans, and the governor's budget seeks to reverse that trend and ask those with higher incomes to pay a similar share of their incomes in taxes as other Minnesotans do. A balanced approach is the right way to help Minnesotans in these tough times and to protect our investments that build a strong workforce and an economy in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Madden. Monica Nelson. And then Brian Roosh, I believe, I hope. Rushi, okay. And then Jen Oscarson. And thank you, Ms. Madden. Monica Nelson.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Monica Nelson, and I am chair of the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless Board of Directors. We consist of 150 organizational members from all corners of the state, preventing and ending people's homelessness. Our organization stands in support of Governor Dayton's proposal as we recognize the need for true shared sacrifice. Of the 13,000 Minnesotans who do not have a home tonight, I have worked with people like a military veteran with serious mental illness sleeping in an ice house on Medicine Lake in Plymouth, families who are bused to Eden Prairie and Eagan from Minneapolis each night for shelter in churches, then bused back to Minneapolis in the morning, then bused to their schools of origin in Rosemount and Apple Valley. A youth named Jenny from Mora, who fled sexual abuse and then became a prostituted youth in the city. Homelessness is not a Minneapolis-St. Paul issue. At the same time, in the tax expenditure side of our budget, the fact of the matter is we are subsidizing snowmaking machines more than we subsidize emergency shelter. More tax breaks for prizes at the state fair than we do with the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act investments. More tax breaks for purchasing horses than for transitional housing for families. Mr. Chair and members, we ask you to prioritize people, Minnesotans, by supporting a balanced approach that includes new revenue based on the ability to pay. Thank you for your dedication and time. We are all working hard together in this room.
And Ms. Nelson, thank you for what you do, and thank you for your testimony. Brian Rushi, did I get that right?
You did, Mr. Chairman.
Awesome. Okay, and then Jen Oskerson, and then this one, Tommy Young. How'd I do? Okay. If you, that's the order we've got here. Brian, Jen, Taomei, and then Karen Ekman. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Brian Rushi. I'm with the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. Our coalition of faith communities believes that Minnesota's revenue system should be marked by two features. The first is sufficiency of revenue to fund social infrastructure, education, and basic human needs. And the second, that the revenue should be raised fairly, that is, based on ability to pay. We believe both these features actually improve our chances and our capacity to be a prosperous people. House File 1231 provides for new revenue that we believe is necessary to avoid the pain of service reductions to people who depend on public programs for essential, life-affirming services. We now have a vivid picture of what a budget plan looks like when it is starved of revenues. It is a ghastly picture. Struggling families, families in deep poverty, many of whom are challenged by disabilities and barriers to work, are being asked to bear the burden of solving this deficit through multiple impacts. These painful impacts span health care, income assistance, transit fares, access to training and education, access to child care, mental health services, the list goes on. This is the inadequacy of the current tax plan laid bare, and why we need portions of House File 1231. That's the adequacy or sufficiency factor. The second principle is fairness, and our tax system needs to tilt towards more fairness. The new tax incidence report that projects tax burdens out to year 2013 shows that the top 10% of households will pay 10.4% of their income for state and local taxes, while households in the middle decile will pay more, 12.1. It is a regressive system overall. Households with only $15,000 of annual income in the second decile
pay over 12%. Okay, Mr. Rush, if you can wrap it up, please. And members, we do have his testimony.
I'll wrap
here.
It up. We support the general direction of House File 1231 in order to advance the principle that human dignity requires us to stop balancing the budgets on the backs of people with the least. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, sir. And I'll go to Jen Oskerson, and then Taomei Young, Karen Ekman, Jim Panino, and then I've got Tom Hesse and Jill Larson. Ms. Oskerson, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
I am Jen Oskerson with Common Bond Communities. Thank you for your time tonight.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I am representing Common Bond Communities. We're the largest nonprofit developer of affordable housing in the Upper Midwest with services. We represent about 5,000 units in Minnesota, Iowa, and Wisconsin. Of that, 2,700 units are preservation units. Sadly, every unit we preserve, two are lost. So what I am here for is to discuss the deep cuts to state funding of multifamily housing and services that will have a dramatic and lasting effect on Common Bond's ability to serve those most in need in our state. Our average resident makes $16,000 a year. This includes seniors, children, family, people with disabilities, the unemployed and low-income families. Common Bond is asking you to support House File 1231. Some things to note. Multifamily housing, including nonprofit multifamily housing, pay property taxes and purchase public land. In Minneapolis, we have just started a project that we're closing on and paying $470,000 for a parcel of land through the city of Minneapolis. In Minneapolis alone, we have 866 units representing about $600,000 in property taxes each year. The point of this is more density means more property taxes and more revenue. Also, multifamily affordable housing programs fuel the economy and create jobs.
Common Bond was stalled in 2008 to 2009 due to the private sector's lack of investors. With the government stimulus package combined with tax credits and other programs, Common Bond was able to create over 300 more homes for people with low incomes, create hundreds of jobs, and create lasting effects on the state as a whole last year alone. Talking about creating a lasting effect, we provide advantage services in our communities.
Ms. Oskarson, if you wrap it up, please.
Yep. Note that of our youth involved in our advantage services programs, we have a 95% graduation rate as opposed to the Minnesota state average of 68%. Last year, more than 530 seniors and people with disabilities were able to stay in their apartments and prevented from nursing home care. Nursing home care on average is about $57,000 a year, compared to the $7,500 a year to keep people in their homes.
Ms. Oskarson,
we estimate $26 million in savings last year alone, keeping seniors in their homes.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the work you do. Tommy Young, if you could please tell me how bad I was. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Actually, you did a very good job. It's Taomei Chong.
Taomei Chong.
Yep. Okay. And I'm the public policy specialist with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. The coalition is a statewide organization with 83 local, regional, and statewide organizations, member organizations. And for the past 30 years, we've been a unifying voice for battered women and domestic violence programs at the Capitol. Minnesota has been hit hard by the national economic recession, and everyone has to cut back, including the Minnesota legislature. We understand that, but it's during these tough economic times that our communities are most vulnerable to violence, and our government leaders need to stay vigilant in making sure public safety, a core government responsibility, remains a top priority. So now is not the time to cut funding to public safety or any other essential government services that helps make our state a great place to live and thrive. We rely on our legislative leaders to develop responsible and balanced budget to invest in Minnesotans during one of the toughest economic recessions of our time. The people of Minnesota need now, more than ever, its policymakers to make decisions that help its people to recover from the economic recession. And a cuts-only approach moves us away from that recovery. Battered women and children in particular rely on these essential and core government services to escape the violence in their life. They not only rely on domestic violence programs to reach safety, but also on the very important financial, housing, and food supports to rebuild a life free from abuse and violence. Our member programs from across the state report that the proposed house cuts to public safety and health and human services would severely impact their ability to keep our communities safe. So, for example, Someplace Safe, an advocacy and shelter program for victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and general crime victims, serves 8 counties. There are Big Stone, Douglas, Grant, Otter Tail, Pope, Stevens, Traverse, and Wilkins. And it is the only state-funded emergency shelter in west central Minnesota, from St. Cloud to the borders of North and South Dakota, covering 6,678 square miles. So with the proposed cuts, they would have to eliminate 5 shelter beds and eliminate 3 full-time shelter staff. This will have a detrimental effect on that area.
Ms. Chong, please wrap it up.
Oh. Another quick example. An executive director from Violence Intervention Project from Thief River Falls said that 100% of their battered women who come to their shelter rely on financial, housing, and food supports. And so with the cuts to health and human services, this would have a detrimental impact to these revolves. So in conclusion, I just want to say that battered women and children cannot afford for the legislature to make drastic reductions to critical services. The budget should not be balanced on the backs of the most vulnerable Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Chung. Karen Ekman and then Jim Panino, and then Tom Hesse and Jill Larson. Ms. Ekman, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Karen Ekman, and I support the governor's proposal. I'm here to represent clean water, our clean drinking water, our water for boating, swimming, fishing, hunting, wildlife viewing, our beautiful parks and natural areas that are just sprinkled with lakes, ponds, rivers, and streams, and most of all, our quality of life that's derived a lot from the fact that we have such a lot of good water in our state. It isn't that way by magic, and it won't stay that way by magic. So I urge you all to continue to protect this priceless natural resource. Clean water is essential to our life in Minnesota. It's what makes Minnesota, Minnesota. So please continue to support the state and local agencies who help us keep and take care of this precious resource. It's my passion for my retirement, and so I just thought I'd show up and remind you. Thank you.
Well, thank you for showing up. Thank you very much. Mr. Panino? Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Jim Panino, and I represent myself. Thank you for this opportunity to speak before the tax hearing.
Welcome to the committee.
A recent Wall Street Journal analysis found that even though productivity rose 5.2% from mid-2009 to the end of 2010, wages increased by just 0.3%. That means only 6% of productivity gains were shared with workers. In past recoveries, that figure has averaged 58%. This time around, far more of the gains went to shareholders in the form of profits, which are at record levels. Why can't the rich, whose wealth is derived from corporations who are heavily subsidized by the taxpayers, pay their fair share? Why can't the rich, whose wealth is derived from the labor of private sector and government workers, pay their fair share? Why can't the rich, whose wealth is derived from corporate investment dividends that are taxed at rates lower than people who actually work for a living, why can't they pay their fair share? Thank you for this opportunity, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you very much, sir. Mr. Tom Hesse, as Mr. Hesse is coming down, there should be a sheet being passed out with the a position statement from Life Science Alley. I just wanted to have that shared with the members. You can take a look at that. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you could please state your name and who you represent.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And let me divide my time into a couple of things. I'm not going to touch on every issue that we have concerns about. Jill Larson will cover some of them, and I just want to echo her comments before she makes them.
Makes sense to me. Have you ever been to Tagus, North Dakota?
No, I have not.
Neat town.
As I've testified before, the chamber has concerns with the proposed fourth bracket. It will have at least two negative impacts on Minnesota businesses. First, as you all know, small businesses flow their business income through their personal return, and the last numbers I've seen, according to the Department of Revenue, about 40% of taxpayers with income in the proposed fourth bracket are organized as S-Corps, LLCs, or sole proprietors. And then second, it will make it more difficult to recruit employees in the state, and we hear that often from our members. Second issue I want to raise is the foreign partnership provision. This is an attempt to overturn a recent Minnesota Supreme Court case. We believe the court got this provision right, where they said a partnership that had its principal office and articles of formation in France should not be treated as its income should not be taxable in Minnesota. One result of the language that we think that is in the governor's bill would be that entities that have two owners would be excluded from Minnesota taxation. One result is the language appears that a foreign corporation or entity with one owner is excluded from Minnesota taxation, but a foreign corporation or entity with two owners is excluded if it is treated as a corporation, but taxed if it's treated as a partnership for U.S. tax purposes, and that result just seems very odd to us. Third item, the Finnegan use of the unitary provision that has often been referred to. Our members believe that it represents a tax increase on Minnesota corporate taxpayers because it is a new tax and they're non-Minnesota affiliates.
Mr. Hess, if you could please wrap it up.
I will. I'll skip the details of that. And I just want to raise...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was keeping track of the
budget. Pretty good, huh? Takes a licking and keeps on ticking.
And if it's okay with Representative Rukkanen, I'll make two comments of things in the bill that we do support or like, with maybe a couple of tweaks. Obviously, the research and development credit increase in the governor's bill we appreciate. And second, the affiliate nexus provision. If there's a provision added to the affiliate nexus provision that would make sure that nexus for sales tax purposes does not create nexus for corporate income tax purposes, we would also be okay with that provision as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hesse. Ms. Larson? Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jill Larson with Minnesota Business Partnership. I will not repeat what Mr. Hesse said, but agree with his comments. We oppose the corporate tax increases in the governor's proposal. As you all know, corporate taxes are regressive. There's been a lot of discussion this evening about the tax incident study and the disparity between the top and the bottom income deciles, and the corporate tax increases in this proposal would exacerbate that disparity. Specifically, we oppose the repeal of the foreign royalty deduction. It sends the wrong message to our high-tech, med-tech, innovation-based companies. The deduction creates an incentive for Minnesota companies to create R&D jobs here. These are high-paying jobs. The repeal of this provision could jeopardize Minnesota-based R&D. These companies can move these jobs anywhere around the country or the globe, for that matter. And if those jobs are moved, we lose not only the royalty income, but the income and sales tax from those high-paid employees that will no longer be here. We also oppose the repeal of the foreign operating corporation. This was a provision that was put into place under the Perpich administration. It was put in place to make sure that foreign corporations were taxed on an equal basis. That is still an appropriate policy. There were changes made a couple of years ago to address some concerns, and we don't think that any additional changes need to be made. We also have some concerns about the economic substance language in the bill. It is very broadly worded, concerns about the definitions, concerns that it could actually be interpreted that a charitable contribution made by a company or an individual would be disallowed because it was done for tax purposes. Last, we have concerns about the taxation of remote access software.
Ms. Larson,
it's a new sales tax. That's it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, so with that, we will now open. Is there anyone else who would like to testify? Come on down. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Mark Tenike. I'm here tonight testifying as a citizen. I live in Minnetrista, and thank you for the opportunity.
Can you please spell your last name?
Tenike. I believe I signed up, but Tenike is T-E-N, capital E-Y-C-K.
Okay, folks, we've gone through our list, so if somebody else has signed up, we'll just hear you. Let's start him over here again. Okay, please present your testimony, sir.
Yes, thank you again, Mr. Chair and members. I am here tonight to testify in support of a tax bill that provides the full complement that citizens expect of programs that protect our natural resources and water quality. And I think it's appropriate to make comments short because the voters, the citizens, have so recently spoken on this subject in adopting the or in passing the constitutional amendment, the Clean Water, Land and Legacy Act of 2008. So it's clear from that vote, from that decision to tax ourselves, that the citizens wanted not only to keep the existing programs, but to raise through taxes some $200 million more per year to go beyond the protections provided in the programs of 2008. So just to be here tonight and ask the legislator, I know there's some tough questions out there, but to work hard to honor the citizens' commitment to raise money and spend it in this fashion. There are some good programs on the chopping block. I think if you look at those, you will see that they're necessary. There's money on the chopping block that would keep raw and untreated sewage from being discharged directly to waters of the state. There's money for water monitoring that I think we need to make good decisions going forward, good investments. And there's money for clean water partnerships, which really give the local communities the opportunity to make decisions to protect land and water quality. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tenney. Anyone else like to testify? If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Wayne Cox. I am Executive Director of Minnesota Citizens for Tax Justice. We're here in support of Governor's tax plan for two primary reasons. We think his plan is the better approach, his plan compared to the approach that's been moving through the House, is better for the economy. We think that there are real risks if you don't have the level of revenue that's in the governor's plan. Let me just go through it real quickly. The state economist, Tom Simpson, said the governor's plan is going to be better for Minnesota's economy. And really, he made that analysis on the basis of it's going to cut fewer jobs. Because it cuts fewer jobs, we have more people spending money in main streets around the state. That money being spent then allows these businesses to keep the employees they have and hire more in the future. It gives them the platform in very tough times to be able to continue their business. We are still in very tough times. We've only brought back a small percentage of the jobs we lost in the recession. So we're not out of the water yet. We need to really focus on jobs. And the governor's plan does a better job of that. Absent the governor's revenues, if we have the House plan as it's moving forward, we'll lose about 10,000 jobs directly from that are supported directly by appropriations. That doesn't even count the number of jobs that would not occur because we would cut back on the federal dollars that would come in through the Medicaid provision. That would be another several thousand of jobs. We can't afford to lose these jobs. The second thing is that there's concern that that we need to spend within our means. What we have is a tax system in Minnesota.
Mr. Cox, if you wrap it up, please.
Sure will. We're no longer in sync with our means. People with highest means in this state have had very high levels of income increases recently. Stock market is up 50% since President Obama's come in. There's no better time to really tap those resources and get Minnesota's tax system in sync with its means. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. Anyone else like to come forward? If you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Yes, my name is Mary Albert, and I represent myself.
Could you please spell your last name?
A-L-B-E-R-T.
Albert. Oh, okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mary Albert. I'm a small business owner, taxpayer, and a proud citizen for this state. For the last past 7 years, I have been a licensed family child care provider working out of my St. Paul home. Each day, I provide up to 14 children and provide them for them with a safe and nurturing environment and help them develop the skill that they will use for the rest of their life. I'm here today to express support for Governor Dayton's proposal to raise taxes for the highest income earners in Minnesota and ask the members of the committee to connect the dots between the revenues that is raised in House File 1231 and the jobs and critical services the revenues will support. Instead of asking the highest earners to pay their fair share of taxes as governor has proposed, your spending bill contains deficits cuts to service to so many Minnesotans count on every day. For example, the cuts of the basic slide fee child care program have a potential of devastating working families, including my families who trust in me every day to take care of their children. If I start receiving less reimbursement of my service, I might not be able to take on the low-income families. In this turn, these families may be unable to find affordable child care to allow them to keep their jobs. Without employment, they would be forced to turn to infill and other welfare programs, which would cost the state much more than if we had made the initial investment in subsidizing their children. Further, the cuts in the state funding to my city, my county, and
Ms.
my school district
wrap it up, please.
Well, I will. will increase the cost of providing my service where I live. As a small business owner working out of my home, providing great service to my clients, and working very hard to succeed, I ask you, please consider adopting Governor Dayton tax proposal and saving the important... tax proposal and saving the important service I talked about, and keep my property taxes down. Please consider investing in our state by supporting the governor's tax proposal. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Albert. Anyone else like to testify? If you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Willie Snyder. I speak on behalf of myself as a caring human service worker.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Thank you for the 2 minutes. I'm a public employee, human services worker, and proud member of AFSCME Council 5. I work the overnight shift with citizens of this state and in the past other states around South Dakota, Wisconsin, and Iowa, who are saddled with severe developmental deficits and multiple harsh secondary diagnoses. Not a one of the clients who rely upon these hands, these eyes, these ears, this voice, whether you like this voice or not, I don't care if I'm my own voice, but it's good on the phone when I have to call 911 for my clients. These big but swift feet and this care, this compassion, this judgment, none of them have asked their creator to blight them with ambulation issues, seizures, non-functioning limbs, psychosis, hyperactivity, diabetes, swallowing issues, intermittent explosive disorder, self-injurious behavior to the point where they blind themselves by knocking their retinas loose from their eyeballs, aggression, property destruction, and so much more. Not a one of them has asked their creator to give them these. They are their burdens that they carry, and these are the people, myself included, and other people in this audience that care about those individuals regardless. It's been suggested that to save money, baby monitors can be substituted for human beings such as myself. Human beings attend to tonic-clonic seizures in which sometimes people stop breathing. Human beings attend to falls that break limbs. Human beings attend to clients who get up at 3 a.m. to throw chairs, enter their peers' bedrooms to remove their bedding and clothing, or run around and try to get onto Rice Street in bare feet and thin pajamas.
Mr. Snyder, if you could wrap it up, please.
At such times, 2 minutes is a very, very long period of time. This speech is a very short 2 minutes. A baby monitor will not substitute for these hands if they were ever needed again to do CPR, which I have, and my 2 minutes is up. I ask you to think about 2 minutes without breath and somebody like a baby monitor, something like a baby monitor taking care of you instead of me.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Okay, the next witness, please. And is there anyone else who would like to testify? Then we'll get into questions. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Okay, my name is Christine Heckler, and I'm representing myself as a taxpayer.
H-E-C-K-L-E-R?
Yes. Okay. I am a social worker with Hennepin County. I work with mentally ill adults. I'm very committed to my job. I'm committed to my clients. I see how the cuts are going to affect the clients and the jobs I do. My husband works for a nonprofit, so he also is very involved with people in the community. He also runs a small business. And I have a brother who's disabled living in a group home, and I'm very committed to the group home and the services they provide. I love my road. I love my schools. I love my neighbors. I love my lakes. Tax me. We make maybe $110,000 a year. If I have to pay an extra $200 to provide services for the things I love and the people I care about, it's not going to kill me. Tax me. Not a problem. I enjoy what Minnesota has to offer. And I enjoy living here. I enjoy giving to the people I'm with. So please, just tax me. It won't hurt me. And just a quick one. I was across the street talking to my neighbors. I live in kind of a conservative area. They're over there saying,
What do they think? They think we're rich to tax me? And I'm looking, I'm like, well, my house is 2,600 square feet. Your house is bigger than mine. Your cabin is bigger than your house. You have, I don't know how many boats. I can look in your garage and see six cars. Tell me what is rich. You know, I don't understand it. We've gotten greedy. So, take my tax. That's
it. Thank you. Please, let's have some decorum in the meeting room. Okay, with that, questions for the author? Oh, we have someone else like to test? Okay. Please join us, sir.
Thank you.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Greg Bastian, B-A-S-T-I-E-N. I live in Minneapolis, and I represent myself.
Welcome to committee, sir.
I've been listening to the debate and the news on the radio and reading it in the papers and stuff like that. And one of the things that has come to me as I've looked at it over time is that if Minnesotans made much more money, if our income distribution hadn't become so unequal, it would be much easier to talk about a cuts-only budget. But because income inequality has grown in the state as it has across the nation, the impact of making cuts without revenue increases will be such that it'll take the people of Minnesota backwards. At times when people that I work with see their incomes declining, they rely ever more heavily upon state and local services. Without those things, without the revenue to help them, their children, and as other people have already testified, their own lives will be made much worse. So unless we were to suddenly become a living wage state where we declared that everybody would make $15 to $20 an hour and set that out as a policy, making people self-sufficient, revenue through taxes is the best way and most economical way to spread the need amongst all the people in the state. I thank you very much for this time.
Thank you, Mr. Bastian. Is there anyone else who would like to testify before the committee? Okay, then what we'll do is we'll go to questions of the author, and we have Assistant Commissioner Matt Mossman here that could join us to help if there's any questions. It'd be my intention to eventually here after questions from members to take a vote on the bill, and then we'll wrap it up. We'll see how many questions there are. Questions for the author? Questions for Mr. Mossman? Okay. We'll go into a short recess. We'll reconvene at 9. What time is it here? 9:45. We are in recess. We'll call the tax committee back to order. I have an announcement for those that are on the tax conference committee. We were supposed to have our next conference committee meeting at 8 o'clock in room 15 of the Capitol. It was supposed to be at 8:30. We had to move that up to 8 o'clock. So if you're on the conference committee, it wasn't my decision. I'm just announcing 8 o'clock Thursday morning instead of 8:30. Okay, with that, any questions for the author? Would the author like to wrap it up, and then we'll take a vote, and then we're done? Or Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. More, I guess, comments than questions, if that's all right, Mr. Chair.
Questions.
More comments than questions.
Either.
Or do we just, okay.
Whatever you'd like.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing this testimony this evening, and to thank each and every person who not only was here but testified. And you know, you talk about, Mr. Chair, real people, and what we heard from tonight were real people with real stories and real concerns and a real impact on the quality of our future in this state. And you know, one of the testifiers talked about the strength of our state, our people. And he said, when you invest in people, you make for a stronger state. And what we heard tonight from the folks who so eloquently testified was the fact that state investments help them get an education, help them get into the workforce, help them turn lives around, and it's making a huge impact. And the governor's tax plan provides the investment to put those dollars in people and to make a better state. And members, that's why I'm supporting strongly the governor's tax plan. And, you know, when you look at the future for our state, it's not just numbers. It's the people that you heard from tonight. And, you know, we can ignore that fact sometimes, and we kind of turn it into kind of just a book assignment, but it's an impact on people that we saw tonight that makes the difference. And a couple comments, too, from, I guess, the meeting the other day that I just couldn't, I was on the list and I didn't speak because we ran out of time, but Representative Downey had mentioned last week that the House plan lowered taxes for lower income individuals. And that couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, if you look at the two plans, I think it's really important because somehow the inference was made last week that the House plan was better for lower income and the middle class than the governor's plan. And that is not even close. Not even close. And I thought, Mr. Chair, that tonight we might go over those tax incident studies on each of the
bills. That's tomorrow.
Oh, okay. On the bills, though, on the governor's bill and then the House bill, there was the
we're going to go over that tomorrow. Okay. But you can certainly make comments.
Okay. Well, Representative Downey, on the second decile that you were talking about and referring to, and somehow made it look like the House plan was better than the governor's plan, the House plan actually raises taxes 5 times more than the governor's plan in that area. And if you look at the bottom 50% of wage earners in the state, the House plan raises taxes. Now, you got to take all the taxes into play, you know, the renter's credit and the property tax and so forth. The House plan raises taxes on the bottom one half of income earners 3 times more than the governor's plan. And, you know, when you look at this, you know, one of the things, and there's several strengths in the governor's plan, but one is the fairness question. That is something that he has talked about, he's committed to, and he accomplishes with this bill. And one of the things here is, with current law and in the House proposal, if you're a senior citizen on a fixed income or you're in the middle class, you'll pay about 22% more of your income in state and local taxes than a millionaire. In the governor's plan, that doesn't occur. He levels the playing field, and that is great fairness. And, you know, you look at the renter's cut, and I know there's a lot of talk and angst about raising taxes on the wealthy. And I know I've covered this before, but if you look at the House plan, and you look at, I'll take someone with a median income who's receiving the renter's credit, and that's just a little under $20,000, but we'll take someone with a $20,000 income who's going to get cut on their renter's credit. And this is someone in the metro area at about a market rent of $8,000 a year. They are going to lose $440 on their renter's credit, $440. And that is 2.2% of their income. And yet, you know, the House plan, folks very enthusiastically pushed the green button to make those cuts. And your enthusiasm has only been matched by your fight to prevent the very wealthy from seeing the very same percentage of income or even less. In the governor's plan, if you're making $250,000, your increase in taxes as a percent of your income is 1.05%, which means the House plan says to a senior citizen, we're going to tax you twice the rate of your income. We're going to increase your taxes by twice the rate of your income, then we're willing to ask the wealthiest Minnesotans in this state to pay. That's what you're saying. And Governor Dayton, and this is why I'm supporting this bill, says that is not right. Here are senior citizens who have built our communities, built our city halls, built our schools and our streets. They shouldn't be paying over two times more in these various plans than the wealthiest Minnesotans. That simply is not fair. So, members, there's a choice here. And we also know that there's going to be compromise ultimately. But the governor's plan is an honest, fair, balanced budget that invests in people, invests in those values that are most cherished in our state, and creates tax fairness for everyone around the state. And did I mention there's no new property taxes in the governor's plan? Unless you own a $1 million home. And so, members, I think when you're looking at choices here, the choice is very clear. If you want to vote for fairness, for honesty, for a balanced budget, that invests in those things most important to folks in the state. And that's why Representative Paymar, I am strongly supporting the governor's proposal tax plan here tonight.
Yeah, Representative Hartman, Knuth Carlson, Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also will be supporting the governor's bill tonight. And the reason is that it doesn't arrive in a vacuum. It arrives juxtaposed with what he does to the rest of the budget. I wasn't willing to vote for the House Republican bill that cut $400 million from higher education. I wasn't willing to vote for the cuts in LGA that would just drive up people's property taxes. I definitely am not willing to vote for a bill that cuts Health and Human Services and the kind of people who testified here tonight. And I don't think that anything that I can say would be as compelling as what we heard from Mary Larson, what we heard from Susie Reed, Emma Wright, the student from the U who talked so clearly about transit and higher ed, Rick Cardenas, Nancy Marie Lund, who's been struggling with mental illness for 8 years, Jamie Platt, who lived in her car with her two kids and uses her GA to help her pay her phone bill that says so she can say goodnight to her kids who are with her mom in Arizona. So I don't think I can say anything that's that compelling, but I do want to say why it is I'm voting for the governor's bill. And it's about fairness, and what you have to look at is all the families in Minnesota. And should some families in Minnesota be hurt by this budget and other families in Minnesota not be touched by this budget? In the newspaper in the Star Tribune on February 8th, when we started debating the budget, I got to see a picture of my constituent, Rochelle Turan, and her son Marshall. And it's a pretty compelling picture. I'm sure a lot of you read the Star Tribune. And it's a picture of Rochelle trying to control her son Marshall. Rochelle was one of the first people I met when I started running for office. She invited me over to her house in 2004 when I was door knocking because she wanted me to understand. That was after those cuts in 03, 04. She wanted me to understand what her life was like with two children with severe autism. And after sitting in her living room where there's no curtains because the kids would literally climb the walls and take the curtains down, there's one picture that was up with bolts and bulletproof glass over it, or this plastic. You know, I left her house after about an hour of talking to her, and I was completely shaken. I wasn't sure how it was that she, every day of her life, got through the day being a parent to these two really challenging children. And I went home to my perfectly healthy, smart, easy to take care of children, who I don't need any staff to help me take care of. I don't need any respite to pay somebody to come in so I can get a break. And I think about what's fair. And I absolutely won the lottery. You know, this year in the recession, my husband has a job. I have a job. We still have our two cars. We still have our house. We're not upside down in our house. And I look at Rochelle and her two kids. And you know, from 2004 to 2011, something amazing happened to Rochelle's son, Taylor. He's in the same grade as my daughter, Sophie. They went to Riverview Elementary School together. Now they go to Jackson Middle School together. And at the end of Sophie's fifth grade year, we invited all the kids over for a party at the end of the year. And she was so grateful. She said that was the first time Taylor had ever been invited to anything. So this kid who was completely climbing the walls in 2004 and who wasn't super under control at the fifth grade party in 2005 was just in a musical with my daughter at Jackson Middle School. He was in Seussical. He was one of the Who's in Whoville. And he was dancing, and he was singing, and he was a part of this musical. He was completely participating. And it was incredible. I mean, between 2004 and 2011, there's been a lot of help provided to this family. And thank God, because without it, where would this child be in his development? And when I look at the Dayton tax plan, for my family, I'm so lucky to be affected by it. It'd be $200. My $200 contribution, if I made that to my church, could not do for Taylor Turan what all of us can do together. And I'm really tired of hearing that the S-Corps with the flow-through taxation are going to stop investing and they're going to take their jobs and go somewhere else. You know what small business people, I happen to know a lot of small business people, very active in the Metro North Chamber of Commerce. What they do when they expect a big tax bill is they go and they spend money because it's deductible. So when they're starting to think, hey, you know, if the people on the top of this who are really going to get hit by more than $200, you know how they're going to avoid the tax increase? They're going to hire more people so they have more deductions. They're going to buy another bulldozer, build another building. These are things, they increase their charitable deductions. These are things that people do when they expect that their tax bill is going to be bigger. And this whole idea that these people are going to move to Florida, you know, I know countless people who have condominiums in Florida, but they have grandchildren here and they have children here. They were educated in these schools. They're absolutely committed to this state. And also they have some sense of honor. They're not going to walk away with the goods after they've benefited from all this investment. What we spend on education allows them to have employees who can work and provide a profit to them. What we spend on the roads allows the customers to get to their business to buy their product. So it's absolutely a fair plan. It's a moral plan. It's the right thing to do. And it doesn't arrive in a vacuum. You know, we had this vote earlier in the year where it was like, just members of the committee, would you like to pay more in taxes? Well, no, you know. The question is, or what? Or what else would happen if we're not willing to do this? And we've seen with the budget bills that have come through, what's the or else? And I'm not willing to have the or else. So I'm completely willing to vote for the Dayton tax bill.
Representative Knuth, Carlson, and Lesh. Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Paymar, thank you for carrying this bill, and to all the people who have come and testified. I think we see here tonight one of the first real debates that this budget has had, and not a debate of members going back and forth in various philosophies, but a description and a discussion about what this means for people's lives. And I heard the emotion in Representative Hortman's voice, and I hope people can hear it in mine, and that's as far as it goes, no further than that. Because first of all, I support new taxes. I voted for new taxes 2 years ago. I voted for new taxes a year ago. I ran a campaign on supporting new taxes, and I'm happy to do that. And the reason I do that is because of all of the stories we've heard here tonight, and all of the things that taxes pay for. The taxes pay for the things we care about, the people we love, the communities we give our time and our effort and our money to support. And at the same time, I'm an elected representative who needs to keep the trust with my constituents. And some of them are here, have been here today. Some of them helped me get elected. And when I ran my campaign,
I said I didn't support Governor Dayton's plan. It went too far. And I think Governor Dayton is an honest, genuine, good-hearted person, good-hearted man who has been completely open and forthright with the people of Minnesota, and he's followed through on everything he said he would do. And I think that's the best we can ask of our politicians. And that's the kind of politician I want to be. I'm going to keep the trust with my constituents. And, you know, I hope we have, in this plan, it's the governor's plan, the legislature's plan, and then my personal trust with the people who sent me here to St. Paul. And they have a whole vast array of opinions. They're a bunch of split-ticket voters and have all sorts of different views. You know, I hope the Republican majorities in both bodies keep their promises to Minnesotans, because the budget we've seen pass doesn't keep that promise. There's over $1 billion of money that's not really there. There's cuts that weren't really made. There was funds raided. There was more revenue used than it said. And so I don't see the promise being kept with Minnesotans from many members of this body. And in my mind, there is no doubt that when you look at the governor's budget and you look at the House and Senate majority budgets, the governor's budget is more fiscally sound. The governor's budget is undoubtedly more morally sound. And if the choice was between those budgets, there's no doubt where my vote would go. And I think Minnesotans need to know that. But I hope that we can heal a divided Minnesota this year. I hope in the next 4 weeks we can heal a divided Minnesota. And we can look at each other across the aisle. And we can say, we need to find a solution that we can all support. That's not a zero-sum game of politics that's saying the Democrats are going to win here, the Republicans are going to win there.
You didn't speak in the microphone. We're not picking it up here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to look in the eyes of my colleagues. And we need, in 4 weeks, to do a better politics than a zero-sum game of appointing back and forth. We need to keep our promises with our constituents, and we need to govern in a way where Minnesotans win. Not where one party wins, not where the other party wins, but where Minnesotans win. And it's hard to not be able to support the governor on this vote tonight. And I know there are people who are going to be very frustrated with me for that. And I know there are people who I do disagree with many things completely who will be glad about that vote. And I think there's two different kinds of no votes tonight. There's the no vote tonight does not mean I don't support new revenue. And the no vote doesn't mean that I don't think the governor's plan is more morally sound and more fiscally sound than what this legislature has passed. But I'm going to keep my promise with my constituents. You can't go door to door to thousands of doors, and when you answer that question honestly, go back on that promise. And I hope my colleagues across the aisle join me and fulfill their promise and honestly give an honest budget to Minnesotans that, if enacted, would actually balance the budget. I hope that happens. And then I hope we all come together, because I think the higher calling of this body is not politics, it's governing. And politics we use to get us to governing, and it can be hard. It's probably the thing I hate most about this job, is that we go through the politics to help us govern. But tonight, members, it's a hard vote, and I hope people hear that it's genuine. And when we finish in 4 weeks, we're honest with ourselves and our constituents, and we do what's right by Minnesotans, and we get some new revenue on the table, because I support new taxes. I can't imagine what this budget would look like actually enacted with all cuts. And I hope my colleagues across the aisle can see that this is a hard
hard thing to do, and I hope my vote tonight helps us come together a little bit and see what it means to govern so Minnesotans win, not so either of our parties win.
Thank you, Representative Knuth, Representative Carlson, Lesch, Dabney, and Loeffler.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be supporting the governor's proposal tonight, and I've said from the very beginning that we needed a balanced approach when it came to resolving the budget difficulties that the state of Minnesota is facing. And that balanced approach, in my view, is to include some revenue as part of the solution. I started to talk a little bit the other day about the out biennium. You know, most of the testimony here tonight was talking about the current biennium and the hardships that many people will face with an all-cuts budget approach. But I did bring up the other day, and I'm saying this mainly for the audience and not as much for the members of the committee, because I hope all of you are aware. But the way the House budget is put together, we have a deficit in the out biennium of $3.5 billion. Now, when staff was walking us through the governor's bill, that helps that out biennium as well as this biennium, but it helps the out biennium by $2.3 billion. And if we don't do something to take care of the structural problems that we have here in the state of Minnesota, each and every biennium we're going to be going through exactly what we went through here today. And the other interesting thing, when you look at the forecast, that $5 billion would have been reduced to $4.4 billion if we had done nothing in terms of the bills that were passed by the majority caucus. So really, you're only improving on the situation by about $800 million when you start looking at the out biennium. And, you know, something that I picked up on with Melissa Hortman, Representative Hortman's comments about being blessed, you know, my wife and I, we've been blessed. And I'm about to say something that I probably, with the background and growing up the way I did, you never talked about your income. But believe me, my wife and I was a school teacher that invested well. My wife was blessed with a good job. We never missed a paycheck. I'm going to be impacted by this bill as an individual or as a family. But another reason I'm voting for this bill, I've got three grandchildren in Minnesota. Another reason I'm voting for this bill, I've got three grandchildren in Minnesota. They happen to be teenagers, one's 16, one's 15, and one's 13. It's not going to be long, and they're going to be attending one of our colleges or universities here in Minnesota. And fortunately, we're blessed again. They're all very capable, and I know if they want to go on, they'll be able to go on. But I also want to make sure that economically that's available for them. And, you know, I taught high school for 34 years, mainly seniors. And my comments aren't just about my own grandchildren, but my comments are about all of the children in the state of Minnesota, making sure that they get a good education, that they have an opportunity to go on to one of our colleges or universities. And the bill for higher education that went through cuts over $400 million from our higher education institutions. And that's going to be made up by cuts within those institutions. It's going to be made up by increases in tuition. We also know that the bills that were put through that are in conference committee also have tax increases. It's the property tax. And I've always believed in a progressive tax system. And I think that's what's on the table here tonight, the retaining of a progressive tax system. Making sure that the citizens of Minnesota are well taken care of and that we invest well in our future. So as I said earlier, I'm going to be voting yes, and I think that's the best way to go to keep a balanced approach to resolving the budget, both this next biennium and the out biennium as well. We've just got to get off that roller coaster.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I had a professor in law school Larry Bakken, in fact, taught government at Hamline University Law School. And he used to say to our class, there are two bills that go through every legislature. The bill that makes the world right for humanity and the appropriations bill. Now, you know what that means. You can vote for A and not vote for B and feel morally vindicated about how you voted for this stuff, but you didn't pay for it, and it means nothing. It doesn't mean a thing. If you're not willing to put your money where your mouth is, that's what Governor Dayton has finally done in coming in his first year. He put his money where his mouth is, his personal money, too. Now, Representative Lincheski also is fond of saying that this is the only committee that can do both raise revenue and spend it, which is critical here because we're not just spending money on the investments that we care about in Minnesota, including education and health care and lowering property taxes. Those all matter. But we're also, the tax bill makes a difference with respect to who gets the benefits of that. We're spending money on these tax breaks for people that don't need them. When you're driving a Mercedes and you break your axle on one of the crater-sized potholes out here, you can take it in the shop. Actually, I think a lot of those have free maintenance for the first 4 or 5 years anyway. You just take it in the Mercedes dealership. For folks like most of us, you notice how bad the roads are when your CD is skipping, and you switch over from the CD to the iPod, which I finally did because it doesn't skip. But the roads are ridiculous out there. We're not investing in them. We haven't been investing in them. If you have a special needs kid and you're rich, you can afford a private personal care attendant to take care of that child and make sure that you can go to the salon or play golf because you got personal care attendant you pay for watching your kid. If your child has a learning disability and is in school, you can hire a private tutor to take care of that kid. Make sure that you get that kid up to speed with all the other children in class. If your kid likes to do activities like go swimming, they just go to the swimming pool in your backyard if you're rich. But if you're not, you got to rely on things like the public pool at your school or at your local park to make sure that your kid has the opportunity to swim, maybe compete. Property taxes go up, and you're rich enough where maybe you just don't write another check for it, but Earl Jr. might have to forego that trip to Europe this year where he can go find himself in Prague and be an artist. Now, members, I passed out a graph that most of you should have. I think I printed off enough copies, full color. Income of the rich versus everyone else. How the average income for the top 1% of Americans compares to that of the bottom 90% since 1945. And you can see this difference between the yellow line and the blue line and how the richest 1% did versus the bottom 90%. And you can see that bottom 90% has stagnated in growth over the course since 1945, members. And you see how the wealthy did. Mark Dayton has come in and decided it's time to right the economic ship. Dayton, as everyone knows, has a famous name in this state. He came from money. He came from a family who did very well with their industry, providing a lot of jobs for the people of Minnesota. And there are people who have been called it shameful. How can you do this when it's your family that benefited from the tax policies that made the rich do well? Well, the fact is, you may remember that during that time, the tax policies were considerably less, what you would call favorable, to very, very wealthy people. FDR was also called a traitor to his class during the course of the Great Depression, when he implemented policies that stated, you know what, it's time to right the economic ship. He implemented the FDIC, the SEC, and many other progressive policies. And in that stock market crash, I remember I was in junior high in 1987. The stock market crash of 87 was considerably worse as a percentage of GDP than was the crash of 29. But we had all those things in place thanks to the New Deal and the Fair Deal and the Great Society that saved the supply-siders from themselves. Now, I feel a little bit sorry for my friends on the other side of the aisle, because your greatest enemy in this endeavor about revenue versus spending is not our governor. It was the governor that we've had for the past 8 years who led you down the primrose path for 8 years, pinky in the nostril, saying, no, things are going to be better. We're just going to keep making sure that no new income taxes get raised, but forget about it. We'll have new fees, sales taxes, and property taxes that we income the lower classes. But don't worry about it because the economy will come around and everything will be better. Well, it hasn't happened. We cut to the bone, and then we cut to the marrow, and here we are. And now we have Governor Mark Dayton, who's come in and offered an honest plan that will ensure that those who can afford to pay among us will pay their fair share. They will right the ship, and again, we'll have him saving you from yourselves. So I think you should be grateful. Members, I'm voting yes.
Thank you, Representative Lesh, Representative Dabney, and then Loeffler. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be brief, for no other reason than some of my colleagues who've spoken before me have been far more articulate than I could be, and maybe more importantly, the citizens who came and spoke tonight and testified have been far more articulate than I could be. They've come forward very courageously, and they've laid their concerns, and they've laid their challenges, and they've laid their tragedies, and they've laid their dreams before us. I have sincerely believed since I was elected 11 years ago that we have a sacred job here and that the people of Minnesota bring their whole self before the legislature and ask us to see it, treat it gently and respectfully, and then make the best possible public policy that we can that sees and feels and recognizes the real stuff of life that we're called on to do so when we chose to run for office. And we're lucky enough, blessed enough, to be elected. And so I listened to those folks. I listened to the businessman who said what I've been saying about the problem of this legislature this year, that it can tell you exactly what it costs to do anything in the state, but it can't tell you the value of anything that the state does and doesn't recognize the value of the quality of life and the opportunity that public services provide our citizens and our businesses each and every day. But the one testifier who sparked more thought in me than the others, perhaps, was the woman who runs the addiction program, who bared very painful parts of her life and talked to the powerful work that she does. My other job, I occasionally work with folks, with men in a treatment facility. And they give powerful stories of the damage that their addiction has done to themselves, to their families, to their children, to their communities. And if we want to abstract it out, the damage that addiction does to our economy and our employers and our jobs when people get into that downward spiral. So I want to thank that woman for the work that she does, because I can believe in the power of helping people turn their lives around and rise up out of addiction and face those challenges. But what she sparked in me was a hope that I've had for 11 years, and it gets worse and worse and worse every session. And I'm supporting the governor's bill because it's the only way to get this legislature off of its addiction to shifts, to budget gimmicks, to denial, to fake numbers, to revenue raids. The governor's budget is the only honest, real, balanced budget that has been presented to the people of Minnesota this year. That's not based on funny numbers and fake money, but actually looks at the state and provides the people of Minnesota with a balanced budget that works for all Minnesota now and into the future. I'll be a yes.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Loeffler.
Well,
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I'm totally sincere in saying thank you all for your patience and for all of you that listened to all the people who testified and for all the people who took time from their life and from their work and from a calculus class to come and share their stories. And for those of us who serve on Health and Human Services, or sometimes it's referred to affectionately as Hell and Human Misery, we get a chance a lot to hear heartbreaking stories as well as heartwarming ones. And I'm very grateful that today that you got to hear both heartwarming stories of success that I think all of us should own, whether you serve on that committee or not. We are transforming lives, and we are turning people into taxpayers that could never have dreamed of that if we hadn't opened the doors of opportunity for them every step of the way. And it takes a lot of courage to stand in front of a committee and outline your deficits. But many of them did today, and they're counting on us. But what surprised me even more is I don't get to talk to very many rich people. I don't represent a district that has a lot of them. And I actually expected today that we would hear from people who would be asked to pay that new fourth-tier income tax. And of the 40-some testifiers that we had, only one even mentioned it. And I'm not sure if that person even qualifies to have to pay that. And of those who said that they would, who admitted that they would have to pay it, they were all in support, except for that one person who raised concerns. And so we had people who are being asked to do that. And I learned something about myself today, because I grew up in a working class neighborhood, and I'm proud to represent one with a lot of renters and a lot of students at the university and a lot of people who are just living paycheck to paycheck. And when you grow up in that kind of community, you get really good at going 2,080 times, because 2,080 is the number of working hours in a year that you get paid. And so 10 cents an hour is $208 a year. And a buck an hour, if you could ever dream of that, is $2,080 a year. But what I found was really interesting is I had to get out my calculator to try and divide big numbers by 12 and to figure out who were we talking about and what were their monthly incomes. And then that answered my question, because the people who we are asking to pay this fourth tier are people who are making $10,000 or more a month. To get to the very top, we're talking about $40,000 a month. And when we're hearing the amount that we're being asking them to contribute, that's less than 10 cents an hour for a lot of people who are paid an hourly wage working in the human services programs and the child care programs that we heard people testifying from. And I think we really have to think hard about not just what is the impact on the people whose lives and services we heard about today, but also about those people who are asking to sacrifice. And I got to say, if you're taking home $10,000 a month, some of what we're asking you to contribute is a pizza every other week. I mean, this is not the... Of course those rich people weren't here today, because if they had heard these stories, they'd say, of course we could pay for that. I've heard from two households in my district who would qualify and would pay for this. One is a young couple. They both just graduated from professional programs at the University of Minnesota, and they're astounded at both their debt level as well as their income. And even though they're struggling with those student loans, they're willing to pay it. I've heard from another established and respected professional in my community, a healthcare provider, who said, if it's going for education, if we're going to do it for the kids, I'm there. And so I can only go from two people in my district, but every one of those people across the state had the opportunity today to join everyone in this room and give their 2 minutes. And for this, I'm really proud of the fact that we didn't hear an outcry of rich people said we're not willing to do our fair share. And I'm really glad to stand with the people who spoke today and give them a chance at a prosperous future. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't seek recognition, but you must have read my mind that I was going to.
very briefly, members, because of the time, I just want to point out, other members have pointed out what this means to them, and I'm not someone who I don't believe is going to be impacted by the income tax increases in this plan, but I think it's important to point out that me as a network engineer, and I'm married to a public school teacher, my wife's income right now, we just did our taxes, that her income is taxed at a 44.7% rate. That's the income tax and payroll tax rate we pay on her income. 44.7, and I'm not in the 28% bracket, I'm not in 33, and I'm not in 35. That's with a 25% federal rate, 7.05 state rate, the 6.2 Social Security tax, 1.45 Medicare, and then a 5% effective rate increase because the per-child tax credit phases out at a 5% rate. So we're paying 44.7 on our income. And the question I just have is how much is enough? How much are we going to take from people? And 44.7, that's before I pay a dime in property taxes, a dime in sales taxes, before I pay a nickel in alcohol taxes, and I'm paying a lot of alcohol taxes lately, I'll tell you that. But the this is before all those things are taken into effect. So the government is taking more of my wife's income than she's taking home. And the question I have is, how much is enough? And I don't think we're ever going to get that answer, Mr. Chairman. You know, Mr. Chairman, a lot of times we ask people, how much is enough? And the answer is always one word. It's more. The answer is more. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be voting against this bill today. I recognize the realities of the world we live in, and the we're going to have to reach an agreement with Governor Dayton on a plan. But taxing savings and investment at a time when other states, such places as Maine, are reducing taxes on savings and investment, that's not the right pathway for Minnesota. Thank you.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if we're getting close to a vote or not, but if we are, I'd like to ask for a roll call on the bill.
Okay, roll call hasn't been requested.
And, Mr. Chair, I'll make my comments brief, too. I was taking a bunch of notes along the way and listening to some of the comments. You know, a few things. We've heard that this is a balanced bill, and I looked at the Ways and Means spreadsheet, and as best I can tell, you take the school shift out, and I think there's $272 million of net cuts in the governor's bill. Compare that to the tax increases. I think that's 11-to-1 tax increases to cuts, and those aren't actual cuts. I think maybe in the governor's budget there's an actual cut from the last biennium to this biennium in higher ed, maybe in environment. It's a little hard to tell. But most everything that we're doing is actually an increase from our spending last time, even when you consider the stimulus and the shifts in there. So I don't think it's balanced at all, and I don't think any fair-minded person would say that an 11-to-1 ratio of tax increases to cuts would be balanced. And to give this some perspective, you know, members, we need to think back over the last 25 years. State spending has actually grown literally at twice the rate of the rest of the economy. And had state spending grown at a reasonably healthy rate, go back to 1985 and play the budgets forward, and assume that our budget had grown at the rate of inflation and population growth, for many, myself included, a very fair measure of maybe the spending growth that's appropriate if we're going to serve our citizens well. And it's not like we were barbarians back in 1985. For many, those are the golden years, I'm told. But you play that forward, and members, we would have a $4 to $6 billion surplus today if we had simply increased spending at the rate of inflation and population growth. And so if you look back at the trends of this state and what's going on in this country, it's the spending. And it isn't just the $34 billion of general fund spending. We're going to spend over $60 billion when you include all funds. You look at Governor Dayton's cuts of $272 million, and remember, that's against the base growth, not against the actuals of 2 years ago. $272 million isn't even a percentage. It's not even 1%. It's 0.7%. of the $34 billion general fund. So to say we're making tough cuts in the governor's budget and that this is a balanced plan, I don't think the facts support that at all. And to support this bill, I mean, think of what we have to assume to be true. And number one, you have to assume that all the spending we're doing is actually working, that all these programs are producing their intended outcomes. you have to assume that we can't get any better. There isn't a way to reform and rethink and deliver in ways that are better, that we can't control our spending, that we just have to live with this growth. And the governor's budget, if you compare it to general fund spending last time, is a 22% increase. If you compare it to last time's general fund spending with the stimulus in there and the shifts, it's still, I think, a 15, maybe 16% increase over the last biennium. People, this spending is absolutely unsustainable. And when you look at what's happening at the federal level, they're going to have no choice but to cost shift to states. They're going to have no choice but to raise taxes at the federal level. They may not even be able to meet their obligations to the state. Look at how many of these programs are hinged on what's happening at the federal level. And Standard & Poor's just downgraded the federal debt outlook to negative. That doesn't mean interest rates are going up tomorrow, but it's not a positive trend. You know, we from a spending standpoint, ignore to our peril the fact that the federal government is literally a couple of dominoes away from not being able to meet its obligations to the state of Minnesota. So I'll end there. We've heard charges that this is a moral document and that somehow those who don't support it aren't supporting something that's moral. Boy, be careful with those kind of charges. There are a lot of people who are going to vote against this bill, who I think are doing it in good conscience, and many of us feel that stacking up this kind of spending trajectory and the debt that's going on at the federal level and piling that onto our kids, a lot of us feel that's not very moral either. And if you think about how this country was formed and what it means to have a free market, and let's just remember that under the rule of law, and with private property rights, and with the primacy of contracts, every transaction in a free economy is a moral transaction. You and I do not transact business unless it subscribes to the golden rule. You and I don't ever do anything in a free market unless it's good for you and good for me, and we agree on that. And remember that when you start taxing people, you start undermining that fundamental, most basic transactional goodness of a free market, and you start to build resentment because the person getting taxed to give to somebody else starts to resent it, and frankly the person receiving it starts to resent the person who gave it, and that starts to turn into political demagoguery. And I'm unfortunately feeling like we dove into a bit of that here tonight. So be careful when we start talking about the rich as some other class. Be careful when you start talking about this thing as a moral document, and realize that there are people of goodwill who believe equally passionately on the other side of that. So with that, Mr. Chair, I already asked for a roll call, but appreciate the chance to make some comments.
Representative Gottwalt, and then Representative Paymar.
Just very, very briefly, Mr. Chair. I, too, want to thank the people who testified tonight. And I want to point out that while I heard tonight about the morals that Representative Downey just mentioned and how the wealthy have more than enough and should give more, I want to remind people the goose that lays the golden egg in this state are the employers, the people who invest, who put their sweat equity, their blood, sweat, and tears into creating businesses and jobs and opportunity, which is what people want. They don't want more government programs. We've seen at the national and state level the results of making promises we can't keep with money we don't have over and over and over again. And we can talk about the spending hole that we inherited. When I came into this legislature, we had a $2 billion surplus. We inherited a $6.2 billion deficit. And now it's $5 billion thanks to the taxpayers of Minnesota who added another billion back to help us out. But if we want to take care of people in need, and Representative Loeffler, you're absolutely right. In our committee, we hear about this all the time. If you want to take care of people in need, If you want to meet the needs of these people we've heard from tonight, you don't do it by killing the goose that lays the golden egg. A 22% increase in spending. I will buy the argument that we need reductions, reforms, and revenue. That's what we keep hearing from my friends on the other side of the aisle. Reductions, reforms, and revenues. New revenues. Mr. Chair, we have $3 billion in new revenues coming in without changing our tax structure one iota. $3 billion new dollars coming in for the coming biennium. Enough for a 9% increase in state government. And when I put that to people out there, people who work hard, people who struggle to keep their businesses going, people who struggle to put food on their table, they scratch their head and they say, why? Why is it that government should be taking more and more and more to then redistribute and give more and more and more when my income's not going up that fast and your income's not going up that fast and the people paying taxes' incomes aren't going up that fast? They don't understand it. When we talk about living within our means, that's what Minnesotans are talking about. They see the growth in government and they don't see it reflected in their own income. And they see the promises the government makes. And they see the deficit and the debt that we're putting on the backs of our children and our grandchildren, Representative Carlson. What are we leaving our grandchildren? They'll pay 80 to 90% of everything they make to government soon. Our labor force is flattening. Our own state demographer told us that. The people who are working to pay taxes is flattening out. The people who are going to need the programs we've made promises about is going like this. So we have the new revenue. And now we need the reforms and the reductions. And what have we heard from the other side? Governor Dayton provides a minimal, I think it's 0.7% reduction, that's offset by a 22% increase in spending, floated by more taxes on top of the $3 billion new revenue. So $3 billion increase in revenue plus almost $2.5 billion. $5.5 billion increase in state spending for the coming biennium is what the governor wants. And I appreciate what Representative Downey said about not only what is enough, but what are we getting for the money we're currently spending, and what is the justification for that kind of increase in government? Is the only answer that we offer Minnesotans putting more and more people on more and more costly state programs, or is it how many people we can get to self-sufficiency? As many as possible. Give them jobs. Give them opportunity. Grow the private sector. Members, we got to think about which path we want to go down here. And I'm voting no tonight because Governor Dayton's proposal takes us down the path of exponential increases in government spending that our economy can't write. Certainly not for the future. So let's be honest with Minnesotans. If we want revenue, reform, and reduction, we've got new revenue, 9% more. Let's work bipartisanly on the reforms so we know that we're getting the best for the dollars we're spending and the reductions, because we have to change the glide path of state spending.
Representative Haymar, could you wrap it up?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Chesney.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if you were trying to end. I think there were a number of other members who were hoping to speak. And if
I have no one else on the list.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, you know, I have a question. If you're trying to get to wrap up first, I'll wait, but...
No, Representative Kamar has the last word.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I genuinely want to ask you what the goal is in this hearing. You know that we heard this bill for a week earlier in the year, and that's as it should be. I certainly afforded Governor Plenty the same opportunity. Of course, didn't vote on the bill because didn't intend to create bad will in the majority when folks need to compromise. But I am trying to understand what the goal is in just plain old hearing the bill right now.
Okay. My goal was very simply to give the governor's budget proposal a fair hearing, let everybody they wanted to talk about it, and then put it up for a vote. The goal is simply to, so we can't say down the road that, well, you didn't hear the governor's proposal, because we have heard the governor's proposal, and I think I owed that to the governor. I said very clearly from day one that I wanted to work with the Department of Revenue, I wanted to work with the governor's office, I wanted his proposal to have a hearing, and as we go through the process, we'll continue to hear from the Department of Revenue and from the governor to make this thing work. So very simply, it cannot be said that we did not hear the governor's proposal in full.
Well, thank you for that, Mr. Chair. And, you know, you had heard it before, though, and I threw it in my toss pile, but I think there were about 30 testifiers that day. So when the bill was testified for and against. So we've gone through it again, and that's great. And I too, like Representative Gottwalt and others, want to thank everybody who came and spoke. And I am moved by Representative Hortman's passion, because as much as I've heard you say, Chair Davids, that sometimes, you know, you just plain old can't figure out how could they be thinking that, you know, I think it's good to hear how people could be thinking something differently than what we think. And so I think that's what the legislature is supposed to do, is honestly try to hear each other. But I did want to ask about, you know, I have to admit I feel some of this is a little bit of a game, and it's not directed necessarily at you, Mr. Chair, but, you know, I think we all know what happens here. I asked Representative Loeffler, who got out her phone and did the calculation for me. The majority has 54% of the Minnesota House, and the minority has 46%, yet this committee has 59% of the majority and 41% of the minority, and you know, we understand how that works. This bill, this committee does not reflect even the legislature. It is supercharged to ensure that the majority will take place in this bill. And you know, I guess I would just ask, is there anyone in the majority who has any intention of supporting, you know, Governor Dayton's bill? And if, you know, no one wants to answer me, that's fine. But if not, I mean, it seems to me that this is just to take it up and to vote it down. And I really think with 27 days to go, I don't think that's particularly productive. You know, I was thinking about, you have 27 days to go, and I've been in this situation, and you know that more than once, and you have to pass, first of all, a balanced budget, which the majority has not done. The majority has not done its first job, which is to pass a balanced budget. That has not happened yet. I know there are people in this room who might quibble about the fact that what's in the majority proposal is real. You know, I, for one, think it is not. But even if it were, it has not yet been passed. Passed means the conference committee is closed, the bill lands on the governor's desk, all big bills. So that's when you've done your duty here, and that is to pass a one honest, complete, balanced budget so Minnesota can see the difference. The governor, Representative Paymar, is carrying it. He did. I mean, he's done that. You know, people don't like it on one side, and I hear that. But, you know, so first we're having, you know, the incomplete problem, kind of what, you know, what's going on in the hearing here. 27 days to go, and, you know, that includes working every Saturday and Sunday, Mother's Day, the fishing opener, and everything else. And, you know, I know people know this in this room, and everyone in the audience and the public, I think, knows this too. But I think it bears repeating, because people, you know, may not want to deal with this, but it is your responsibility to pass the budget. It is your responsibility to pass the budget, and even harder, and I've done this. I've spent lots and lots and lots of time with Governor Pawlenty doing this, and I will tell you that we got done on time with agreement. Two rounds, and passed multiple tax bills, including the jobs bill, federal conforming. They're all signed. They all happened. And how did that happen? We had to compromise. And majorities have to compromise with governors. It's not fun. But the responsibility lies with the majority. That is whose responsibility it is in this very room to pass, number one, a balanced budget with real money and get it out of conference committee and put it on the governor's desk. Not pass it off the House floor and pass it off the Senate floor. That does not meet the requirement. that the Constitution lays out. It must be put on the governor's desk. So that hasn't happened. And so the concern I have in raising this is, why after we heard this for, you know, a week, a few months ago, we're spending, you know, time going backward. The clock is ticking, 27 days to go. This time could have been spent in the Tax Conference Committee, actually working on a deal. And I'm not saying that folks aren't working on it, but I do want to say to Representative Davids and Representative Gottwald and Representative Draskowski, Representative Anderson, Representative Runbeck, unless there's another member I've missed in here, you are chairs. And Representative Garofalo, this is your job. So you've got a few days here to kind of get the whole thing done here. And, you know, that that's what people are required to do. And so, you know, I do want to, if I may, Mr. Chair, and, you know, this is a big bill and a big vote, so I hope it's okay to take the time to talk about it. You know, I listen to, every Friday, I listen to the leaders of the four caucuses do their press conferences. And if you don't watch them, speaking to the public now, who may watch this on a delayed broadcast, you can just go on the House and Senate websites and go on to press conferences, and you can watch them every week. And I watch them every week because I like to hear what the four of them are saying. And Senator Koch and Representative Zellers have said they're done compromising. And it's April. So Senator Koch, I'd encourage you all to go listen to it. She said, you know, the governor said we're on the 20. He's on the 20. We're on the 20. We came in on the 50. We're done. And then Representative Speaker Zellers and Senator Koch said, and we're not having revenue. We're done. That's not negotiable. So, you know, the sort of statements are, we're done, and it's April. And, I really hope that no one in this room and the majority feels that way, and you, the chairs all here, feel that way, because it is your job to solve this in 27 days. And we want to help you, and we want to be a part of that. It just feels like in this room that something's afoot. I loved that we had real people come in and talk to us. But you know, I understand, and I think I laid out how the vote's going to play out here, whether every Democrat votes for it or doesn't. We heard Representative Knuth. If every Democrat votes for it and every Republican votes against it, it's going to fail. So, you know, it's over tonight on this particular bill. We understand that. But, you know, it's sort of, to me, it's sort of defend this. Defend this. Somebody needs to defend that we have an incredibly unfair tax system. And I heard Representative Downey talk about the federal issues, and Representative Garofalo talk about the federal issues. And I will remind you, you've heard me talk about before, Warren Buffett, the richest man in the world, takes this side's position here and says it isn't right. I think, Representative Garofalo, you made the argument that we're trying to make here. Your wife, 44%. Governor Dayton thinks that's wrong. Governor Dayton thinks that your wife, who's a teacher, should not be paying a higher burden than the top wealthiest 1% of Minnesotans. So I think you're kind of making our argument, but I also want to give you a lot of credit for, you're the one person in the room who has said you recognized the reality that you need to compromise with Governor Dayton. And you're right about that. And time's a ticking, and I know Representative Downey talked about, you know, we did the school shifts and we didn't cut enough. You know, you're doing the school shift and you haven't cut enough to balance the budget. And so, you know, I heard you, I don't think you meant it threatening, but I heard you three times tell us to be careful. I'm not sure what that means. I think be responsible, pass a balanced budget on time, cut a deal with the governor in 27 days. You know, I think that's the responsibility. And I heard Representative Gottwald say, look out for the golden goose that lays the golden egg, and the goose that lays the golden egg. And you know, if you think about, you know, the real conservative philosophy there, the goose doesn't ask for a handout. And our tax expenditures, our tax code is riddled with preferential treatment for those job creators. And you know, if we got rid of them, we could cut all income taxes 25%. So, you know, if we want to talk about the goose, what kind of goose? The goose that's getting all the preferential tax treatment? You know, so we need to be clear on what that really means. I really think this summer everyone should go read Atlas Shrugged. You know, Jason Lewis just wrote an article about it in John Galt, and folks should go back and read it. And I think you'd have a hard time coming back in here and defending all these things that we've got going on that we're not willing to address. We had a speaker talk about you spend less on the homeless than on snowmaking machines. And that's true, we do. And yet nobody wants to look at that because that's revenue. So, you know, it isn't that we don't want to help, but the democracy requires that the majority passes a balanced budget. And so, you know, we've got to get going on that 27 days. I want to be helpful on that. I hope it's within 27 days. But, you know, I guess I would say whether we had a surplus, let's say we had a $5 billion surplus, you cannot justify this. You just, in my mind, you cannot justify the tax incidence in the state of Minnesota. And it's getting worse. And if you don't like this, Representative Downey's criticized this document a lot. Let's use the Minnesota Taxpayers Association. Let's use the Minnesota Taxpayers League. Let's use Freedom Foundation, anybody's. And it's just a magnitude, but the wealthiest pay less as a percentage. Let's use Representative Lesch's handout, anybody's. Let's just use it. And even if we had a surplus right now, you cannot defend this, in my mind. That's my value. You cannot defend this. And so it isn't just about the deficit. Governor Dayton is laying out, you know, how do you justify that Warren Buffett's getting a better deal than his cleaning lady? And he is. So, you know, we have different views on how we're going to vote here. I want to thank Representative Paymar for carrying this bill. He's worked really hard, and, you know, he's been under no illusions. I heard what he said at the very beginning of this hearing and the last hearing. You know, he knows that we all have to compromise, and the minority's role is to also help with that. But the majority has to pass a deficit or pass a figuring this out. And no matter how all of us vote on this roll call, and I think people can guess where I'd vote, but I've been willing to support new revenue. I've carried it. This act, I guess, here to me is not moving us where we need to go. We're still in the incomplete stage of the homework, still getting incomplete. We don't have a balanced budget yet that the majority has passed. We don't have a budget that's dealt with that phony $1.2 billion, and we don't have a balanced budget passed to the governor's desk. So I really hope after we dispense with this tonight, which I think is what's going to happen, we'll really get serious tomorrow morning about taking steps. And I hope the majority has a press conference tomorrow and announces the move they're going to take to begin to compromise. I mean, I think Senator Koch and Representative Zeller saying they're done is concerning. And Minnesotans should be concerned about that. And I appreciate you allowing me this time to speak about this, Chair Davids. But I really hope tomorrow, with 27 days to go, we'll get to work on what we're really supposed to be doing.
Thank you, Representative Lancheski, Representative Rukavina.
Chair, I wasn't even going to talk, and the hour is late, but you know, I got to contribute to the babbling a little bit here, too. So, you know, I've been keeping track for you new members of the richest 50 people in Minnesota since we cut the income tax in 99 and 2000. Representative Garofalo, you know that. And I'm sorry, and Ms. Mansi has been updating me on a regular basis. Every year she updates me. Because that was when Governor Pawlenty called the a fourth tier proposal by the Senate back then in 2004 or 5 profoundly stupid. And so I just wanted to know how much that little income tax cut in 2000 and, or 1999 and 2000 gave the richest 50 people. Well, the Department of Revenue, according to what Ms. Mansi told me, won't give me exact numbers because we might figure out we're talking about, you know, Glenn Taylor or somebody. So they give us 51 one year and 53 or 55. And Representative Garofalo, in answer to your question, how much is enough? How much is enough? 58 people in Minnesota have a combined adjusted gross income of $2.738 billion. How much is enough? 58 people get to play around with $2.738 billion, and we gave them $16.4 million with that little tax cut in 99 to 2000 because evidently they couldn't pay their electric bill. And Representative Garofalo, let me tell you something about capital and labor. Because the capitalist can't do a damn thing without somebody implementing his money. If there's a nuclear war, Representative, I don't want to end up with you. I want to end up a guy that can weld and do stuff with his hands. Well, good. I'm glad you can do something with your hands. You do enough with your mouth. But anyway, you know, it's labor that creates wealth, not just capital. And the laboring community in this state is getting the shaft. And today you were downstairs trying to take away prevailing wage, which is a Republican proposal. So, you know, Representative Downey, I'll end up with you. You said we could have had a surplus of $4 to $6 million. We could have. We'd have a surplus today if we hadn't changed the funding formula for K-12 schools, like I keep telling you, where your school district got money for the first time in 2002 and nobody ever paid for it, and where we took over a transit levy with the sales tax on cars in 2001 also. So the wealthy suburbs got $1 billion, basically, of money they never got before, and we cut the income tax the 2 years before by close to $1 billion. So, yeah, we could balance the budget if we just went back to the way things were. And the only person that testified today that kind of hit the nail on the head was that Commissioner McDonough, was that his name? Yeah. Your Commissioner McDonough? Who said, and I remember the quote, we got boatloads of money, let's cut. We can cut the income tax permanently. We can take over school funding for everybody permanently because the economy is growing. You know, we've never touched those two formulas that happened in 2001, but we've gone after everybody else in this state. Now, Representative Garofalo, 58 people have an adjusted gross income of $2.738 billion. How much is enough? That's my question to you. No, I'm going to proudly vote for this bill because I'm a Democrat who believes in fair taxes, and I believe in taking care of these people. Finally, Representative Gottwald, I can't believe, maybe I've been in the wrong legislature over the last 4 years or 5 years, but in 2007 when we took back the House, we had a little bit of money. I wanted to change our Enron accounting practices. I lost to the Speaker. I didn't get support from some of my own friends sitting at this table to go back to where we counted inflation on both the spending and the revenue side, like we always did in this state before 2002. But I lost that battle. And in the next year, we had House File 1812, my good friend Lynn Carlson, and we cut in 2008. We cut in 2009. We cut in 2010. We took $27 or whatever it was away from the most vulnerable people in this state to balance the budget. I go and visit them at Lutheran Social Services in those homes where there's three or four people that we have to take care of because they're so medically and mentally handicapped, and we took their toothpaste and comb money away from them. We ought to be ashamed of ourselves. How much is enough? That's way too much. Let's tax it a little bit.
Representative Paymark?
Well, Ms. Chair, members, I gave my speech really at the beginning of the introducing the bill, and again, I'm proud to be the author of the bill, and I just want to say, like, the last few weeks, you know, I've had this bill in for quite some time now, you know, I'm on the House floor and all the newspapers, I keep hearing from the leadership of the majority that there's not one vote for the Dayton plan. And while not everyone on the minority will vote for the Dayton plan, you're going to see a lot of yes votes. You know, we really believe that there needs to be a balanced approach. This is not political demagoguery. And you know, I guess I would reiterate my challenge to the majority that you know, the governor is saying, you know, if you don't like the rates I'm putting out there, then come up with a plan. But he's not compromising on not having some revenue on the table. And that's just the reality of it. And Mr. Chair, you know, sometimes the press, you know, misquotes us, and sometimes we misspeak. And I hope that neither one of is true after reading over the weekend what you said. And I hope this isn't true, but you said if the governor doesn't cave to GOP demands, the shutdown is on him. Well, I served in this body when we had a partial shutdown, and we all get blamed. We all get blamed. And we all should get blamed if we can't come together and work this thing out. At the end of the day, we're all Minnesotans. And
maybe I should have sent Puckett.
Oh, I'm sorry.
If I maybe yeah, I read
the
it wrong.
Was incorrect, but maybe I just shouldn't talk to the press so much. It's not that's not what I said. Oh, whatever. Okay.
All right, yeah. But I you know I mean we at the end of the day here I think it would be a sad commentary if we can't figure this out and work on behalf of all Minnesotans. I urge your support for the bill.
And thank you, Representative Paymar, for carrying the bill. The committee legislative assistant will take the role on the bill.
Representative Davids?
No.
Representative Loon?
No.
Representative Lincheski?
No.
Pardon me? Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Bills? Representative Biskins?
No.
Representative Carlson?
Yes.
Representative Crawford?
No.
Representative Dabney?
Yes.
Representative Depke?
No.
Representative Downey?
No.
Representative Juskowski?
No.
Representative Erickson's excused. Representative Garofalo?
No.
Representative Gottwald?
No.
Representative Hortman?
Yes.
Representative Kiffmeyer?
No.
Representative Knuth?
No.
Representative Koonin?
No.
Representative Lesh?
Aye.
Representative Loeffler?
Yes.
Representative Mack?
No.
Representative Marquardt?
Yes.
Representative Myra?
No.
Representative Paymar?
Yes.
Representative Rukavina?
Yes.
Representative Renbeck?
No.
Representative Tilbury?
Yes.
Representative Wardlow?
No.
There being 9 ayes and 19 noes, the motion does not prevail. Representative Paymar, thank you for carrying the bill. Members, good government all the time. We are adjourned.